Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Earthblood. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Thomas Penny, Casey Platt, Tim Carlin, M.B. Van Dorn, Dylan Lynch, Terrence Aselford, Ren Casey, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, Elizabeth Demery, Tim Getman, Michael Glenn, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Eric Messner, Mort Shelby, Jason Stiles, Nan Savard, and Lily Beacon. Earthblood, Book 3, Aurora Quest. Having scattered themselves to every quarter of what used to be the United States of America, the survivors of the Aquila, in their two groups, were gradually drawing closer to each other. Jim, Heather, Kerry, Kyle, and Sly had seen the amended billboard for the Acme Coyote Trap, a little way north of the Bolinas turnoff. They saw it as potential encouragement for their unknowable future. At the moment that the other group, Nancy Sims, Jeff Thomas, and the McGill family, stopped to stare at the same billboard, they were less than 50 miles apart. The highway had been completely blocked by a massive landslide at Tamales, sending Jim and his group on a detour to the east toward Petaluma. But they were able to cut north again before they lost too much time and distance. They were traveling in 2x4s, with Jim driving one and Kerry the other.
Whew. Must have been a big quake.
Kerry was at the wheel, and she nodded.
Sure must. That crack across the highway was a good 50 feet wide in places.
Was it the San Andreas?
That went macro at the end of the 90s, didn't it? A lot of folks died in San Francisco and around.
Sly had been dozing in the back, and he came awake with a start.
Where am I?
We're just moving on to that place where we might find us some new friends.
Sly grinned, the smile lighting up his face.
That'll be there, won't he?
Kyle turned around to face the boy.
No. Remember that Steve's gone to a special place. He can see and hear you all the time, but you can't see him.
Never and never, amen.
But there should be some more children in Aurora, Sly.
Kyle turned back to raise his eyebrows at Kerry.
If we ever get there.
The next morning, after a late start, they carried on through a torrential storm. The wipers worked overtime, but visibility dropped to less than 20 yards. With dumped and wrecked cars everywhere, it became impossible to drive much above 10 miles per hour. Even then, Jim nearly crashed into a burned-out Army half-track that had been left slewed halfway across the median line. There was another fierce shower a little later, heralded by strong gusts of westerly wind. They were going up a steep incline when Kerry encountered more evidence of recent quake activity. Half the highway had slipped yards to the right, and she suddenly found, to her dismay, that the rear end of their truck was going a whole lot faster than the front end. It took all of her skill behind the wheel to correct the skid and bring everything back online.
That was fun.
She and the others remained silent most of the day, anxiously intent on the road and weather conditions. They didn't wait until nightfall to look for a secure campsite. They'd taken an unmarked cutoff that wound toward the coast, down a narrow lane with high banks of dirt. The quake had shifted some of it, but heavy rain had washed much of it away, leaving a layer of fine sand and orange mud that was less than a foot deep. Treacherous, but drivable with care. They passed a number of small cottages, every single one with broken windows and smashed doors. Most of them had tumbled roofs, opening up the rooms to the elements. Eventually, with the leaden surface of the evening Pacific visible beyond a slope of dead bracken, Jim Hilton spotted a larger house. It stood alone on a bluff, looking relatively undamaged by either the quake or by looters.
Spend the night there!
He pointed toward the building.
Good enough!
As they drew closer, Jim realized that the appearance had been deceptive. The high gabled roof had lost most of its shingles. They lay in piles around the sides of the house like a shower of fallen leaves. The attic windows of the landward side were mostly broken. Those that stared blankly out over the sea were salt-stained, but still whole. Dark green shutters dangled from their shattered hinges over the first and second floor windows of the abandoned house, and the large double front door gaped open like a sucking, toothless mouth.
And whatever walked there, walked alone.
They stood together at the front of the building.
Sure looks haunted. Still, there might be some dry floors, and we can find plenty of wood to burn. It's gonna be a cold night.
Ghosts.
Sly stood shivering and hugging himself with a delighted grin.
Steve told me all about ghosts and lamp irons and stuff.
Lamp irons?
Jim Hilton looked at his daughter, Heather, knowing that she was the best at interpreting the teenage boy's occasional linguistic oddities.
Dunno, Dad.
Heather turned to Sly.
What's a lamp iron?
I think it's a bad man that looks like a bat and drinks blood.
Oh, vampire.
Sly, you mean a vampire. Now I get it. A vampire, Sly.
They filtered up the wooden steps and into the building. Jim pulled his Ruger and led the group in case some threat waited inside. The desolation within made them look around in wonder.
Looks like it was empty before Earthblood came along.
Yeah, stripped.
There wasn't a drape or a carpet or a stick of furniture anywhere in the building. An ominous crack ran down the northern wall, so wide that it was possible to put four fingers deep into it. Kyle was a fan of horror novels and movies, and he remarked how it reminded him of some old story.
Great big house alongside a black bottomless lake. A crazy man lives in it, with his sister, who's dying. I think it was Vincent Price played the madman. Decides he's buried his sister alive, and she comes back to life, and then they die together. The wall splits, and the whole mess slides into the pool. Of course, stupid of me, it's Poe. The fall of the House of Usher. My memory's getting worse.
We going in?
Sly had been ignoring the conversation about the melancholy house.
We are in.
Oh, yeah, I mean, we going to eat?
Good question.
Jim grinned, ruffling the boy's hair.
We'll get a blaze started, and then we can have some supper. You and Heather go and pick up as many of those wood tiles from the roof as you can and put them in there.
He pointed to a wide, carved fireplace. Much later that night, Jim leaned across and ran the tip of his tongue down the angle of Carrie's shoulder, tasting the salt of fresh sweat. He continued across the swelling top of her breast, found the shrunken nipple, and kissed it softly. It rose at the touch of his lips, hardening against his tongue like a tiny animal.
Man your age should be sated and sleeping by now.
Woman your age shouldn't rightly be copulating with a man my age. And me, your commanding officer as well, second navigator princip.
Copulation.
Her hands slid between their bodies and grabbed at him.
I wish you'd call it making love, Captain Hilton.
She gave him another, gentler squeeze.
Oh.
Sir.
As you were, my dear second navigator.
He eased himself up on one elbow, disentangling the long strands of her blonde hair from his face. He ran his tongue over his lips, savoring the taste of the young woman, then glanced at the watch on his wrist.
What's the time?
12:15. These days, it's up to you to keep your own soul, Carrie. The Lord's turned his back on us.
There was no answer, and he realized that she'd slipped away from her half-waking world.
Gotta take a leak.
Jim rose in the empty silver-lit room, wriggling out of the double-quilted bag, trying not to disturb her again.
Jesus, that's cold.
The dusty woodblock floor was chilly to his bare feet, and Jim wished he'd kept his socks on. The hall held an armory of angular shadows. There was a heart-jumping fluttering from a pigeon far above him in the exposed rafters as it shifted its position. Jim was padding toward the stairs, feeling for the balustrade and finding the large carved acanthus at its head. He picked his way slowly down to the first floor. For a moment, Jim paused on his way to the open front door, imagining that he'd heard the sound of movement somewhere from within that room.
Lamp iron.
His smile disappeared as the sound was repeated, not a product of his imagination anymore. He clenched his teeth, bitterly angry with himself for leaving the Ruger Blackhawk Hunter up in the bedroom alongside the sleeping woman. He froze there, halfway between the front entrance and the stairs, aware of a tall figure appearing, silhouetted in the doorway to the right.
Please don't try to do anything stupid.
Someone's trying to flag us down.
I see him.
Nancy tapped on the brake pedal of the 4x4 they had stolen from the Hunters of the Sun. warning the two vehicles behind her that she was slowing down. In the Jeep and the Phantasm were the McGill family. Henderson McGill, his first wife Jean, their son Paul, and the McGill daughters, Jocelyn, Pamela, and Suki.
You think it's a trap?
Nancy didn't reply at first, but watched her mirror to make sure that Jean McGill, at the wheel of the Phantasm, had spotted the signal.
Doubt it. Road's wide open. Can't see any way there'd be an ambush around here.
Are we stopping?
Why not? Get that .38 cocked and ready for use, Jefferson. I'll pull up a little short. Get your window down and cover them.
There was a cool evening breeze blowing in off the Pacific, less than 5 miles to their left. Wraiths of mist clung in the dips in the switchback blacktop. They hadn't been back on the coast highway for long, after the detour where a bad quake had blocked their way. The man wore a plaid shirt and working jeans, tucked into hiking boots. He held a brakeman's flag, waving it slowly across his body. Nancy spotted an automatic of some sort tucked into the broad leather belt, and a hunting rifle was slung across his shoulders. His long, dark hair was tied back from his ruddy face with a green bandana. The 4x4 stopped 20 paces short of the stranger, and Nancy wound down her window.
Don't come any closer. State your business from where you are.
Jeff Thomas was ostentatiously showing his own handgun through his window.
Sure thing, lady. Glad to see folks taking care of themselves. We seen some seriously stupid people passing this way.
Yeah? What do you want? Warning us of a roadblock?
Hell no. In a way, it's the opposite.
His laugh revealed a fine set of strong white teeth.
We got a community settled down near the beach. Every now and again, one of us comes up here on the chance of seeing outlanders coming through.
You see many? Particularly, have you seen any sign of...
He stopped dead as Nancy leaned across and casually laid a hand in his lap, gripping so hard that the words choked in his throat. His face turned gray, and sweat burst from his forehead at the pain.
Quiet, Jefferson.
She flashed a big smile for the benefit of the man with the flag.
Never, ever talk when you can keep your mouth shut.
Didn't hear you.
The man took a couple of steps toward them, but halted when Nancy waved a finger at him.
Sorry, didn't mean to. Listen, you folks would be real welcome to come down and join us. There's some old huts and cottages and a few tents down there. Not like a real village. New town is what we call it.
He shrugged and grinned boyishly at her.
Not very original, is it? We got food and some fuel, and we want decent people to think about joining us.
Why?
Henderson Mac McGill had jumped down from the Phantasm and now stood alongside Nancy's truck with a Sig Sauer P-230 in his hand. His son Paul had joined him, holding one of the Winchester Defender 1700 12-gauge shotguns.
You mean... what's in it for you, mister?
Yeah.
Safety and numbers. How many you got in your party? Around a dozen at the most. Time will come there's no more gas to steal from isolated places. Then you gotta settle down. Better amongst decent God-fearing people than some murderous rabble. Unless you all got somewhere better to go.
We're just moving on. Lot of sense in what you say. How many in your community?
The man tucked the flag into the waistband of his pants.
Around 30 at the moment. 8 are little ones, under 10. Most are married couples.
How do you eat?
There was a heartbeat's hesitation that only Nancy Sims noticed.
Fish is plentiful. We send out groups to scout the hills inland, and they bring back good things for us. And the Lord Jesus provides.
What do you think, Nancy? Worth the risk of staying a night?
Maybe. It's just when I hear someone talking about the good Lord providing, I tend to reach for my scattergun. Still, we can leave a guard on the vehicles, especially the gas, and keep our eyes wide open. We can try it.
Glad to visit with you down in Newtown.
Hey, that's good. That's real good. Everyone will be so happy to see so many strangers.
It was the best time any of them had enjoyed since the beginning of Earthblood. Newtown was just as the flagman, whose name was Jed Harmon, described it. An easygoing assortment of old cottages and huts clung to the top of a steep cliff above a bleak and rocky beach. There were two good fires burning at the center of the community, and everyone came out to welcome the arrival of the group of strangers and their three vehicles. Despite Jean's warnings, both Suki and Jocelyn disappeared with a group of other small children, whooping away into the gathering dusk. The rest of them were ushered into the biggest of the huts, where most of the adults pressed them for news of where they'd been and what they'd seen. When supper time came, They were served a rich stew flavored with a mix of herbs and spices that rather dominated the taste of the meat. Jean licked her lips, turning to the young woman next to her.
What's in it?
The stew?
Yeah. Is it pork?
Right. That's what it is, Jean. Finest pork.
After they ate, Nancy caught Mac's eye while they were sitting around the blazing fire, drinking some kind of coffee substitute flavored with a bottle of brandy that Jed Harmon produced with a flourish from his own cottage. Nancy leaned into an older woman next to her.
Gotta go. Do you have some sort of outhouse?
The woman pointed toward the cliff.
That way. Find your way by your nose.
What if I go up the other way, beyond where we parked the vehicles?
No!
All right.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to snap. We place a lot on keeping the whole of Newtown clean and sweet. Anyone starts taking a dump in the wrong place and we're off to hell in a handbasket. See what I mean, Nancy?
Sure.
Mac stood and stretched.
I could do with pump and chip as well.
He and Nancy began to walk off together into the cool darkness beyond the fire. Three of the Newtown men also rose and began to follow them. Nancy and Mac had a momentary lead.
What?
Just an uneasy feeling. No more. Said they got a lot of fish. I haven't seen a boat around, and you couldn't catch anything off those rocks at the bottom of the cliff.
Guess not.
Watch carefully, Mac.
The three villagers caught up to them, and they all walked along together. Nancy had been ready for some kind of attack as she squatted among the dead brush, but nothing happened.
All right.
Sure. You all go ahead. Find my own way back. Can't miss the fire.
She waited a couple of minutes longer until she was sure that the three other men had returned with Mac. Then she pulled up her panties, fastened her trousers, and took the Heckler & Koch P-111 from its holster and began to move. She didn't head directly along the well-trodden trail, but skirted the outlying buildings toward the part of the community that the woman had seemed so keen for her to avoid. Nancy ghosted through the dry dead bushes, the barrel of her gun probing at the air ahead of her. The vehicles were to her right, safely parked and locked. Beyond them, a narrow trail, forking off the main road into the community, was just visible in the half-light of the cloud-masked moon. Nancy glanced behind her and chose the least taken path. The wind was rising, and the high tatters of cloud were moving quickly, bringing patches of darkness and then moments of brightness. Nancy caught a smell and wrinkled her nose in distaste. She paused. The ground opened ahead of her in what might have been an old quarry or some kind of refuse pit, but it lay in deep shadow like a black lake. The short hairs at the nape of her neck were prickling, and every nerve was tense with the realization that something was grievously wrong. The pink-tinted bushes around her crackled in the breeze, and the moon suddenly broke through, darting silver lances into the pit just ahead of her.
Of course.
Nancy realized many things in that moment of ghastly horror. She stood before piles of stripped and mangled bones, human bones, eyeless skulls and splintered ribs, the flesh peeled off them, sliced off, boiled off, cooked off.
Please don't try to do anything stupid.
My mother didn't raise stupid children.
That sounds good to me. Nice to meet up with someone whose brains haven't gone into terminal meltdown as a result of earth blood. Most folks let their guns or their knives do their talking for them.
Jim didn't think it was the right moment to mention that if he'd had the sense to be carrying the power Ruger, the speaker would be down and dying.
We saw you coming in. Two male adults, one female adult, teenage girl, and a boy our watchers thought was probably Down syndrome.
Jim Hilton saw no point in trying to be evasive.
Girl's my daughter, Heather. I'm Jim. Other man's Kyle. Other lady's name is Carrie. The teenage boy is Sly.
Good to meet up with you. I'm Diego Chimayo. Me and some friends are trying to run a hydroponic center.
Getting greenery back after Earthblood?
Yeah, doing well. Got stuff germinating we thought might have been lost. But their seed's still doing well despite the plant cancer having killed the mother strain.
Look, if we're not going to kill each other, how about waking the others and we can talk properly?
Sure, but...
What?
One thing, Jim. Been hearing about some sort of crypto-fascist crowd.
Hunters of the Sun?
Yeah, right, Jim. Have you seen them?
Some. They bothered you?
Not really, but... Well, someone fucked up our water supply a day back. When we saw you, we... But now we know it's not you. It's just talk locally about these hunters.
It's more than talk.
Diego Chimayo was in his mid-20s and had studied plant genetics at Tupelo. There were a dozen with him on the project, mostly in their earlier mid-20s, working in ramshackle huts under glass or heavy-duty plastic. Most of them had associated degrees or a botanical or agricultural background. The small complex was up a dirt road with low hills around and a sheltering basin. Jim noticed as they drove in that the only token nod toward defense was a three-barred metal gate that dragged on broken hinges. Diego had told them that there was another route in, across a wooden bridge near a long-abandoned mission. Then down a crookback trail that would lead them out into a farm road, and then eventually onto the highway. The place was incredibly low on transport, with only a flatbed that had a busted front axle and a little Nissan compact sedan with transmission problems.
What do you do for transport? Your vehicles seem to be in rough shape.
A young blonde woman named Harriet, who was breastfeeding an 8-week-old baby girl, offered an explanation.
Doesn't much matter since we don't have any gas.
Actually, we don't need to go far for what we need. Not that there's anywhere to go. We grow all the food we need here on site by our own labor.
The meal was top-heavy on bean sprouts, which seemed to be the easiest to produce hydroponically, and was larded with legumes and some delicious mushrooms. An eager, skinny black teenager piped up.
Got tomatoes and loads of squashes coming along. Melons look good, and if you come by here around early spring, then there'll be more of all the small fruits. Strawberries, and we reckon some decent dwarf apples and pears by then.
Jim could hardly believe the good feeling that he got from being surrounded by such positive and eager young people, and to see green again. Nothing had ever looked quite as good to his eyes as the growing shoots in their neat rows under the steamy heat of the hothouses. A narrow stream that flowed down behind the living quarters powered a wheel that gave them a fairly regular supply of electricity. After the meal, Diego took them on an extended tour of the project, proudly showing them their successes and their comparatively few failures.
What we found most is that the man-made and genetically engineered plants, like hybrid roses, for instance, don't seem keen on returning. The same with some fruits. The more exotic they are, the less we've been able to breed them.
I thought broccoli was kind of exotic. At least I remember hating it when I was a kid back home. Used to try and smuggle up a big mouthful to the John to spit it away. Mom caught me and squeezed my cheeks, and it went all over my favorite Mutant Scum Legion t-shirt.
We got a small plantation out back near the stream. We're trying trees there. Pines do well. Not much successes with some of the deciduous varieties, though we've got some oaks that are 3 or 4 inches high and thriving.
How long will it take? Years, won't it? So what's the point of bothering?
The young man shook his head and patted her on the shoulder.
It's Heather, right?
Jim Hilton's daughter nodded.
Well, Heather, we aren't talking about tomorrow.
I know that.
Let him speak, kitten.
Don't call me... Sorry. But I guess it seems... The world's fucked, isn't it?
Heather! Watch that language.
But she was beyond that. Her eyes narrowed, her mouth tight with anger.
It is, Dad. We all know it. Earthblood's killed out the whole world and everything on it and in it and under it. It's all over, Dad. Can't you see?
Hilton shook his head, feeling his own short-fused temper beginning to flare at his daughter.
It's not over until...
It's totally over?
Right. What's happened might have killed nearly all the plant life throughout the world, killed nearly all the people, wiped out all the cities, brought human life as we know it right to the brink of the pit. Sure, all of that, Heather.
Right.
So?
So that's what I'm saying. What's the point, Dad?
Jim swallowed, feeling a vein pulsing across his temple.
Right. I see why you think this. Everything you knew and trusted in life has gone like it got chainsawed off the planet. But remember, I kept saying the word nearly a lot, didn't I?
Yeah.
That's what I mean, Heather. Look around you. Seems likely Earthblood itself has died. new green grass and vegetables, little trees that'll turn into mighty oaks and redwoods and sycamores and aspens, fruit just like there used to be. It won't be like it was.
But how long will these trees take?
She turned to Diego Chimayo.
To grow to maturity?
Yeah, I guess.
Depends. Some grow fast. Piñon could be a couple of feet high in less than 10 years. Oaks are faster. Willows are quick. Most redwoods are slow starters. Fruit trees can be quick.
But when will Earth look like it did before the disease?
Before Earthblood?
Diego shook his head, solemn-faced.
I guess it'll never be the same.
So?
It will be different. I know you can't see this, or maybe understand it, but we have to think way, way ahead. Planet's been here for millions of years. Last 50 years, man's been harming it in a big way, Heather.
I know, Diego. They told us about it in school.
If the work we do here can be sustained and carried on in other places by other people, then in 100 years, I reckon that we can have a fairly green Earth again. But who knows?
Will they be doing this up at Aurora, Dad? Growing new plants and all?
She caught the expression on her father's face.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Dad.
Diego had been offering Sly a tiny fresh carrot to taste, but he spun around at the mention of Aurora.
You know about that place? Where is it?
We don't know the location. How come you heard about it, though, Diego?
You sure that... When we heard about these Hunters of the Sun, it was partly from a stranger we picked up on the road. Got shot. Said he'd been ambushed by the Hunters. Got delirious and died. But he talked some about a kind of haven called Aurora.
We think it's north, but we have no specific idea where.
Jim looked around the range of buildings, each with its own precious crop.
I think that you should consider seriously about all coming with us somehow.
A nice joke, Jim. Get us a fleet of, say, 400 trucks, temperature controlled, and about 6 months' work getting a new site ready. Then we'll all be right there with you up in Aurora.
Okay, I hear you. But you're vulnerable here to any attack. You said your water was messed with already.
True enough. The Hunters?
What we hear is that they want to stop this sort of project. Doesn't fit with their plans. You talk freedom, and they think control. You talk green and light, and they think crimson darkness, Diego.
The fresh fruit and vegetables, after weeks of canned foodstuffs, had a disastrous effect on their digestive systems. Kyle was particularly hard hit, having to get up several times during the night to pay visits to the pair of malodorous wooden latrines that stood close to the water wheel. It was on his fourth visit, just after 3:15 on a cool, clear morning, that he heard it.
Ah, shit!
Kyle realized that they had company.
All right!
Without any warning, Jed stood up and pulled out a pump-action Smith & Wesson 12-gauge.
That'll about do it!
Immediately, there was all sorts of chaos. Most of the Newton folks seemed as surprised as Mac, Jeff, and the McGill family.
Enough! Mike and Saul, go get the old woman. Rest of you, calm down and keep our guests covered.
Harmon saw Paul McGill fumbling for a pistol from the back of his belt.
Don't do it, friend!
Mac had been taken by surprise, despite Nancy's warning. He turned over in his mind what she said about there being no boats, although Harmon had claimed they depended for much of their food supply on fish. So where were the pigs that had provided the meat for the stew? The fresh meat on the hoof that the jokes had referred to? The penny dropped, too slow and too late.
Holy Mary.
He spoke just loud enough for Gene McGill to hear him, as they sat close together under the barrels of half a dozen guns.
What's going on? They aiming to rob us, Mac?
No.
What then? For Christ's sake, Mac, what?
Shut the fuck up, will ya? Keep your hands out in front.
The order came from a skinny woman in a raggedy dress with an open sword disfiguring her forehead.
What?
Jean cuddled Suki to her.
Eat us.
Mac hardly believed the words himself. The good folk of Newton were over the top excited. The drunk couple had linked arms and were dancing around the fire, faces flushed, pointing to their mouths and rubbing their bellies. Mike and Saul reappeared, shaking their heads.
No sign of the old bitch.
Must have heard the noise and run for it. Still, a scrawny old slut like that would have made good.
The sneering, triumphant face of the man simply exploded. The sound of the shot seemed oddly delayed, as if time itself had been hindered. The dead man hadn't even fallen forward into the pile of burning branches, his shotgun dropping to the trampled dirt. Illuminated by the fire, paralyzed by the hidden threat, the Newton men and women were absurdly simple targets for someone as good with a handgun as Nancy Sims. Mac himself hadn't begun to react sensibly before there were six down and dying, the shots coming a heartbeat apart from the surrounding blackness. Paul was faster, so was Pamela. Both of them snatched at their handguns and opened up on the panic-stricken mob that was vanishing in front of them. Not a single bullet had yet been fired in retaliation. Now all the firearms came into play. Mac leveled and fired, screwed up against the pungent smoke from the blazing logs. Paul and Pamela were on either side of him, Gene just beyond them, and Jeff Thomas, standing spread-legged, blasted off with his captured .38.
Stop shooting!
Predictably, Jeff Thomas was the only one of the group who ignored her order, firing at one of the younger women, who was a vanishing blur, running toward the rocks in the ocean. Mac's first quick guess was that over half of the community was either dead or dying. He could see and hear three or four more who were rolling around with gunshot wounds. The few survivors of the cannibal commune had disappeared into the surrounding scrub. And then Nancy stepped out of the shadows, as calm as if she'd come across the last moments of a Presbyterian church picnic.
Finish them, Jeff.
She pointed with the muzzle of the machine pistol at the trio of wounded.
Don't waste bullets. Cut their throats.
Both Suki and Jocelyn stood up and walked with the ex-reporter, wanting to watch what he did. As he knelt down beside the first victim and quickly drew the blade of the butcher's knife that he'd taken from one of the corpses across the man's neck, Jean rushed up, horrified, to whisk the children away. One by one, Jeff did away with the wounded, pulling away from the gushing fountains of blood that pattered back in the firelight. Pamela McGill looked to Nancy.
That it?
Nancy nodded.
Doubt any of them will come back. It was a real neat killing.
Paul was already working his way around the bodies, checking for weapons and ammo. He looked back over his shoulder.
More of a bloody massacre.
Were they really? Oh.
Jean found herself unable to even say it.
They were cannibals. Had some suspicions, and then I found their bone pit.
Then that stew they said was pork?
Wasn't pork.
Pamela dropped to her knees. Suki was fortunately too young to appreciate it, but she also knelt down and imitated the others who were vomiting.
Shouldn't we go after them while they're running and wipe the sick-minded sons of bitches off the good earth? I'll be real happy to be the one to throw the switch on them right now.
Nancy was reloading the Port Royal.
No point. Thing you have to learn and live with, Jean, is that the world has changed. What went around came around. The good old rules aren't any good anymore. Just old. The times have been a-changing, and you can't just get away with blocking windows and then sitting hopefully out in your hall. You must understand that if you're going to be of any use to your husband and your children. Do you see? Because seeing is the first step toward understanding.
No. Truth is, Miss Sims, Nancy, I don't actually understand a single fucking thing anymore. I see dead plants every moment of every waking day. I've already seen more bodies in the last months than the average mortician would see in a lifetime. Seen my children die. Pulled the trigger and blown living flesh into gray corpses.
Mac holstered his gun and went to his wife, putting his strong arms around her and giving her a great hug.
Tears are just salt water that gets in your eyes and stops you seeing clearly.
Oh, fuck you too, lady.
That's better. Anger is better than grief, Jean, believe me. Not many people left on this planet know that better than I do. We aren't going after these mind-sick bastards because there's no profit in it for us.
What about other folks, Nancy?
Jeff Thomas wiped his bloodied hands on the long skirt of one of the dead women.
Warn them, you mean, Jefferson?
Sure.
Nancy patted the younger man on the cheek, making him flinch instinctively away from her. Mac noticed the movement and wondered about it.
Bleeding heart liberal Democrats, aren't we all? Newtown's finished. They needed numerical strength to butcher strangers. They lost that. And the odds are they'll fragment and drift away from this unholy place.
Not our business. Should move on ourselves.
Good lad.
Nancy Sims favored the 18-year-old with a rare warm smile.
That's what I was struggling, perhaps a little clumsily, to say to Eugene. We must only look out for ourselves and each other in this group. To be alone is to be weak. To be weak is to die.
As a small concession to the others, Nancy agreed that they should linger for an extra 20 minutes or so. Long enough to splash around some of the 10-gallon drums of cooking oil that Suki discovered in the biggest hut, and fire the whole settlement. The flames were whipped up by the rising easterly, spreading rapidly through the makeshift huts. Billowing clouds of dancing ruby sparks quickly ignited the dry brush around, starting a blaze that swept toward the coast. It also started a backdraft that threatened their vehicles, leading to a hasty withdrawal away up the dirt road toward the highway. Jeff Thomas took the wheel of their 4x4 and led the way out, nervously watching the orange glow that filled the rear mirrors.
Slow down, Jefferson. Don't get too far ahead of the others.
Fire's big and getting bigger.
Jeff leaned forward in his seat with the effort of concentration, jerking the vehicle to the left as a deer, spooked by the inferno, darted across under the front wheels. Nancy was leaning back, relaxed, wiping at a smoke smear on her cheek, showing not the least sign of having been instrumental in the killings of 20 or more human beings less than an hour ago.
Remember that objects in the mirror may appear smaller and more distant than they really are.
Why don't we leave the others, Nancy?
She patted him on the knee, allowing her hand to crab its slow way upward over his thigh. Her hand settled comfortably in his groin, distracting him enough to make him drop back to less than 20 miles per hour.
Good old loyal Jefferson.
She squeezed his swelling erection through the jeans.
Never change, do you? I said there was safety in numbers. The McGills got gas, got plenty of firepower, and they all seem to know how to use it. We'll stick with them. For the time being.
General John Kennedy Zelig sat behind a large plain desk and leaned his chin in his hands. The calendar showed the date of December 15th, 2040. The battery-operated digital clock clicked over another minute, changing the time to 16:37. He wondered how much longer the battery would last and made a quick note on a scribble pad of yellow paper to ask someone to check their supplies for spares. The office was in one of dozens of almost identical Quonset huts that lay beneath camouflage netting in a remote valley away to the snow-shrouded north. It was a part of the ultra-secret complex that was known by its codename of Aurora. The space insignia hung on the opposite wall. Its maroon background carried a circle of tiny silver stars. Zelig looked at it, his mind hundreds of miles away. Then his gaze moved to the large map of the western half of what had been the continental United States of America. His powerful hands clasped each other like long-lost brothers as he looked at the dozens of tiny pins that dotted the map, some clustered in nests. Red, yellow, blue, green, orange and white, and black. The black gathering, mainly in the vicinity of Las Vegas, Nevada. Margaret Tabor, the chief of the Hunters of the Sun, sat alone in her office at a similar desk, looking at a similar map. Only hers was computer-controlled and covered with hundreds of flickering lights. If you could have put the two maps side by side, you'd have observed uncanny similarities in the patterns of the lights and the pins. The biggest difference between the two opposing forces and their intelligence was that Tabor didn't know where Aurora was, though she was feeling increasingly confident that her far-flung recon patrols were getting closer all the time. Now it was narrowed down to an area close to what used to be the Canadian border in Washington State. Their computer predictions had it hidden in the suburbs of Seattle, but the chief's personal guess put it either in the Olympic Mountains or up in the Cascades.
Always a man for trying to take the fucking high ground, weren't you, General Zelig?
The socio-psychology program that occupied her 4 years out at UCLA flooded back into her mind.
Make sure you get both the territorial and the moral imperative.
The main keyboard linked to a sophisticated console lay at her side. Margaret Tabor turned to it. She keyed in the code to search for probable locations of the missing members of the crew of the crashed Aquila. She still found it difficult to believe that she'd have the old woman and the journalist actually snug in the palm of her hand, and then, through the foolishness of others, allow them to escape. Hilton and the others were far from being the only people whom the Hunters of the Sun wanted to contact. There were others, men and women who might be enlisted to the cause of the Hunters of the Sun, or men who might well prove of greater value to Zelig and his friends, who would therefore be of grave potential harm to the Hunters of the Sun, and needed to be removed. All of the existing evidence seemed to place Captain James Hilton and the others in the latter category. Her fingers moved confidently over the concave keys until the screen gave her the access that she wanted. The bulk of the lights on her map dimmed, drawing attention to those colored silver. The brightest was not all that far away from her base, Stevenson, where the USSV Aquila crashed from the sky and flamed out on landing. They tapped into crew information, so there were single lights at the homes of everyone. Margaret Tabor knew them all by heart.
Hollywood for Hilton, Aspen, Colorado for the radio experts, Steve Romero. Jeff Thomas, the journalist, resided in San Francisco.
An additional pair of lights to the north and west of Vegas showed where Thomas might be at present, with the woman.
The bitch. Dangerous bitch.
Henderson McGill, the astrophysicist, had lived in New England, with two wives and a brood of children. She frowned at where he might be now. They'd checked up in Mystic and found only a burned shell of a house and a couple of graves. There'd also been graves at the Hilton home. Other glittering silver points of light indicated New Orleans and Albuquerque, Carrie Prinsip and Kyle Lynch. Jed Hearn had been the electronics whiz kid of the crew and came from rural Vermont. And the last of them who were believed to be alive, Pete Turner, from New York. Communication in the crumbled society was so much more difficult to sustain.
Where?
Her suspicions linked them to the old ghost town at Calico. There had been a gathering there, and the hunters searched for clues.
Hard enough? Maybe not. Maybe not.
She reached for the intercom to order a top team back into Calico. In her heart, there was a growing suspicion that this might be a nodal point. If they could find something there, then that could open up some routes to pursue Hilton and his team. That part of the hunter's plans was assuming disproportionate importance to her. She knew it, but it had become a compulsion. Zelig stood up and walked around the room, stopping in front of his pin-studded map. He was a well-built, muscular man who'd been a running back at West Point. Now into his 40s, he was a little thicker around the midriff than he wanted to be, but he worked out every day in the gymnasium. The pins that interested him most were those that applied to the movements of the crew of the Aquila. The project wanted to pull in all manner of people with all sorts of skills, but Hilton and the others were his people.
Or what's left of them.
They'd only just picked up the message at Calico Ghost Town. On his instructions, his team left it where it was in case others came along. They also checked out the wreckage of the Chinook, though they knew there were no survivors. Now they were trying to get through to Muir Woods, hoping for another clue there, despite its being already 10 days past the original rendezvous. However, the results of some major quake activity in Central California were proving a problem for his patrols. But time was racing by, and the weather was deteriorating. They had plows at Aurora, but if they worked too well in keeping highways open, it would point to their location as clearly as a giant scarlet arrow. Zelig shook his head and walked back to the desk and sat down. The word battery stared at him from the pad. He took out his fountain pen and wrote in a firm, angular hand, with green ink, a memo to himself.
Send team south to search for incomers.
Hearing the noise of secret intruders creeping up toward the hydroponic plant complex in the darkness, Kyle picked his way out of the waist-high brush as quickly and silently as he could. He carefully slipped into the long, narrow hut where Jim Hilton, Heather, Carrie, and Sly were sleeping on folding bunk beds. Easing the door shut behind him, he winced at the noisy hinges.
Jim.
He lay his hand on his friend's shoulder, ready to clamp it over his mouth if he made a noise.
Jim.
Jim was instantly alert.
Trouble, Kyle?
Visitors.
Hunters?
Can't tell.
How many?
Didn't wait to find out.
Their whispering woke Heather, and then almost simultaneously, Carrie. Only Sly Romero remained snugly asleep, hands folded across his chest, like the statue of a crusader on his marble tomb.
What is it, Dad?
Kyle.
Kyle heard someone coming.
Hunters?
Carrie was already pulling on her pants and reaching for her boots. Kyle bit his lip.
Shit, I don't know. Heard a footfall. Someone swore. Trying to creep up on us. I didn't stop and ask him for his social security number.
Hey, who rattled your cage, Kyle?
Just cut it out. Heather, wake up Sly. And for the Lord's sake, don't let him make any noise. Carrie, you and Kyle go out with the kids and wait by the vehicles.
We running?
He couldn't conceal the surprise and doubt in his voice.
What about...
I'll warn Diego and the others.
And then?
Jim straightened up, drawing the Ruger, the blued steel gleaming in the pallid light that filtered in through the hut's dusty windows.
No time for a balanced debate. I'll warn them. Take a quick look around. Might be a loner or a couple of vagrants hanging around. If it's more, we get out the back door. No arguments. We come first, right? You all agree?
Nobody spoke.
Fine. At least you don't disagree.
Jim Hilton ghosted out of the wooden building, into the darkness. He checked his watch, finding that it was 3:29 in the morning. The air tasted flat and cold on his tongue, with the distinct flavor of salt from the Pacific, close by them to the west. One of the first things he'd begun to notice after their return to the blighted earth was how much cleaner the atmosphere was, making it easier to catch scents. Now he could smell the gasoline from their vehicles and the rich odor of the plants beneath their transparent covers all around him. Jim thought for a moment that he saw a brief flash of light on the far side of the mill, like a flashlight being switched quickly on and off, but he couldn't be sure. Whoever was coming after the place was coming in fast. He hesitated, his mind swamped with an overwhelming desire to get out quick, to make sure that his daughter and Carrie, Kyle and Sly, were safe. The GPF 555 Ruger Blackhawk Hunter in his right hand gave him a measure of confidence. An ounce shy of 2 pounds of metal, it was loaded with 6 rounds of .44 caliber full metal jackets. For 10 beats of his heart, Jim Hilton stood very still, holding his breath, listening and waiting.
Behind that building!
There. On one of the survivalist weekends Jim enjoyed in the happy years before Earthblood, there'd been a special course on urban self-saving, run by a tall, quiet-spoken Encino woman in her mid-20s. Jim ran over the lessons in his head.
Don't wait. That's rule 1. Rule 2 is not to wait. Rules 3 through 50 are all the same. You wait, and you're down on your back with the rain falling into your open eyes.
Based on that advice, Jim considered blasting away into the damp blackness beyond the narrow stream. But bullets got you through times of no money a whole lot better than money got you through times of no bullets. Instead, he moved as quietly as he could toward the largest building on the site, which was the sleeping and living quarters for the young enthusiasts. The door handle was moist under the fingers of his left hand as he turned it, easing his way inside.
Who's that?
The voice sounded to Jim like Harriet's, the young woman with the baby.
Me, Jim Hilton.
What is it?
Trouble.
That was all it took. In less than 45 seconds, everyone was awake and dressed, all done in complete silence. Diego Chimayo came over to stand by Jim at the center of the room.
The hunters, or whatever they are called?
Don't know. Kyle heard a noise. I've seen a light over near the mill.
You know how many, Jim?
No idea. Mob-handed is my guess.
We'll try and stop them.
What sort of armory you got, Diego?
The silence was so intense that it seemed to grip Jim Hilton by the throat. At the far end of the room, a mother picked up her baby and held it to her breast. It was still and quiet, outside and inside.
Diego, guns, what you got?
There was a flash of white teeth in the gloom as the young man smiled and shrugged.
I guess we don't have what we should have here, Jim. Not really. There didn't seem any need to get ourselves protected. Growing the plants was what counted.
Not really!
Jim grabbed him by the shirt.
Just what does that mean, you ignorant bastard?
Hey, stay free, Jim.
Stay fucking free yourself, kid. If that's the Hunters of the Sun creepy crawling out there, and it looks like it might be...
What?
Jim let go of his shirt.
Oh, Jesus, son.
The bright rage suddenly trickled away, leaving him feeling tired and defeated.
Then it means you probably die.
Why would they do that?
Why not?
You know, we got a pair of shotguns, but there's only a couple of rounds for the 10-gauge. And there's a .32 someplace around here. A little Saturday night special kind of gun. Got 4 or 5 bullets in it.
Jim closed his eyes for a moment, trying to think.
They'll massacre you, Diego. All of you.
I ask you why they do that, Jim.
You got something good and positive here. The kind of project the planet needs to replenish itself and offer the hope of a greening again. Hunters of the Sun don't want that. Not unless they control it.
Help us.
Diego reached for Jim, fingers brushing his jacket.
You've got some good guns and you can use them. Save us, Jim.
I can't.
The stillness outside was shattered. Flashes of golden fire burst in a dazzling display through the dusty windows, illuminating the shocked faces of the group. Jim spun on his heel and ran to the door. He opened it a crack and peered out. Coming up the main track toward him, he glimpsed a half-track personnel carrier. Some of the hydroponic greenhouses were already well ablaze, giving enough light for him to make out the Arrow and Sun insignia painted neatly on the front of the oncoming vehicle. He eased the door a little wider, and a chunk of wood splintered away a couple of feet above his head.
Don't go! Don't go! Jim!
Jim didn't waste time on any more talk. He slid through the partly open door like a gray rat up a drainpipe and ducked away to his left, running in a crouch. Bullets tore great furrows in the sand around his feet as he scampered toward the waiting vehicles, waiting under his breath. The attackers wouldn't be aware of the back trail. The personnel carrier had an LMG on its turret, and it opened up. A spotlight gleamed from the darkness, resting backward and forward like a hunting dog, trying to pick out the dodging man. Ahead of Jim Hilton, the light went out. He recognized Kyle Lynch's Mannlicher Model V rifle, one of the 357 rounds guiding its target.
Keep me covered! I'm coming in!
Desperately, Jim plowed on, stumbling and falling, catching his knee on an agonizing crack on a jagged rock, half hidden in the dirt. Jim glanced once behind him, seeing that several of the hydroponic units were already burned, smashed, or both. The light of the fire showed a number of armed men darting from building to building, smoky blue flames blossoming where they stopped. Carrie appeared out of the blackness, holding her little .22. She grabbed Jim by the sleeve and pulled him roughly to his feet.
You hit?
No. Banged up my knee. The others?
By the trucks. Come on, Captain. Time to haul ass out of here.
It was the best advice he'd heard in a while. Even if they'd rallied around Diego and the others, their own weapons were totally outclassed by the overwhelming firepower of the Hunters of the Sun. Simply, it would have been a futile sacrifice on their part.
The big hut's blazing!
Kyle was standing by the two trucks, the hunting rifle carried at the high port. His eyes were white in the darkness. Jim looked back once more. The dormitory building was well on fire. As he watched, the door flew open, and a slender figure appeared. At that distance, it wasn't possible to be sure, but before the man, who might have been Diego Chimayo, could shoot, he was hit by a burst of automatic fire that almost ripped him in half and sent him tottering down the steps, the gun falling from the bloody limp fingers.
Give me the rifle.
Why?
Just fucking do it, Kyle! Then get in the trucks. Heather and Sly safe?
Both in your four-by, Jim.
Fine, go get in. Kyle, wait for me a couple minutes. Carrie, take the four-by and head off the back trail, fast as you can. And safe as you can. No lights.
Seven left, including one under the hammer. Got spare mags in my pockets if you need them?
No! Want to slow them up. Discourage them, Kyle. Get in the truck!
Suddenly, Jim Hilton was alone. Frozen in a vacuum, behind him he heard two engines idling. Ahead, the experimental plant unit was being destroyed in front of his eyes. A second spotlight was working, focusing on the tumbling remains of the hut that had been home for the group of young idealists. A tall figure appeared, silhouetted against the flames, and threw something inside that erupted into dazzling, oily fire.
Bastard!
Hilton focused the sniper scope on the soldier, centered on his chest. Finger gently on the trigger, he squeezed. But seeing the killer go down and lie still wasn't satisfaction enough. Before he turned and ran to join Kyle in the second of the four-bys, Jim emptied the magazine of the Mannlicher into the group of men by the armored personnel carrier. He didn't wait to see how successful he'd been. It didn't even up the score, but it stopped the murderous sons of bitches exulting in a bloody victory. That was something. 15 miles out of Fort Bragg, Jim Hilton found that the old Highway 1 was blocked again. A bridge had fallen, probably as a result of more earthquake action, making further progress north toward Eureka impossible along the coast. The map showed a back road that cut east toward Laytonville on 101, through a village called Branscombe. It was partly unpaved and went across the South Fork of the Eel River. They all peered at the Rant McNally.
Could be tough going.
It was mid-afternoon on December 16th, 2 days shy of their projected meet at Eureka, which was still at least 120 miles farther north. Heather looked around them.
Do we have a choice?
The weather had turned cold again, and they'd been running through groves of timber, mostly stiff and dead. But some of the bigger redwoods had shown encouraging signs of having survived the Earthblood virus and were green and healthy.
What's blue?
Sly pointed at the map with an eager, stubby finger.
The sea. Pacific Ocean. Guess that would be another choice, wouldn't it, Dad? If we could get a hold of a boat somewhere?
Possibly. Rather keep our feet dry for as long as we can, though.
Blue sea, new me, blue bouncy booby, with new knee and poopy, poopy, pee and poopy.
Yeah, that's enough, Sly.
Kyle patted the teenager on the back, though he was unable to restrain his own broad grin. Carrie was again at the wheel of the first truck, Heather at her side. Jim was taking a rest in the second 4x4, allowing Kyle to drive, with Sly sitting between them. Kyle wasn't too confident going much above 10 to 15 miles per hour, but that didn't matter, since the stretch of dirt road was deserted, with only an occasional homestead. The only sign of life, apart from a circling flock of gulls, was a small pack of wild dogs that came running from a thicket, barking wildly, snapping at the wheels. Carrie put her foot down, and they soon outdistanced the malevolent animals. About 3 miles farther along, they reached a hamlet so tiny, or recent, that it didn't even merit a black dot on the road atlas. A tilted sign proclaimed that it was called North Barrel, and its population was 19. It didn't even have anything that could properly be called a main street, two frame houses and a ransacked general store. It only took about 30 seconds to drive from one end of North Barrel to the other, where there was a white sign with an arrow pointing off to the right. Cameras, trade, buy, and sell. Video movies and stills. Film for all.
Hey!
Carrie heard a hooting from behind her and slowed her truck right down when she saw in the mirror that Kyle was flashing his lights at her. She stopped and leaned out of the window into the cold drizzle that had been falling steadily most of the day.
What is it?
Cameras! Been wanting to try and get one for a couple of weeks. This could be my chance.
He paused to say something to Jim in the cab with him.
Captain here says it's all right, second navigator, Princip.
Can't disobey both my superiors, Navigator Lynch.
Carrie turned off up a driveway in the direction of the arrow. Kyle kicked up gravel as he accelerated after her up the hill toward a distant single-story building with a flat, dark green roof. When they got there, the group of five got out of the vehicles.
What a mess.
Kyle stood with hands on hips, staring at what once proclaimed itself to have been the best camera emporium in Northern California. Most of the windows were broken, and the door was missing. Heather accompanied her father on a cursory recon, while the others waited by the vehicles. Heather came scampering back.
The kitchen's burned out, and it looks as if everything inside had been smashed.
Everything?
Broke the cameras and equipment, Kyle.
But they wouldn't have been much use. Not once society had broken down. Where's Jim gone?
Having a look around the back. There's loads of outbuildings and barns. Saw a dead horse.
Let's see a horse.
Sly started eagerly forward, but the girl grabbed his hand to stop him.
No, not very nice. All maggots and stinky. Stay here with me. Come under the porch to get out of the rain, Sly.
Carrie and Kyle watched as they walked together and stood on the front veranda. The young woman hunched her shoulders.
What is it? Cold and wet?
Old one about someone walking over my grave. Just find this sort of thing real sad. I understand looting for food, not mindless damage by a bunch of shit for brains. Don't get it.
Jim reappeared around the corner of the camera store, holstering his Ruger.
I heard that, Carrie. Probably starving and terrified young shit for brains. Didn't find anything to keep their bellies from rubbing on their backbones, so they took it out on everything else they found.
Anything interesting around?
Guess it was a farm 10 or 20 years ago.
No food?
Hilton shook his head.
No, Kyle. But I saw foot tracks in the mud. There's some stinking bedding in one of the small barns. Some bones there.
Animal or human?
Oh, animal. Birds, I think, mostly. Reckon some scavenger was living there.
Maybe it was him did the damage?
Or her.
With evening closing in and the weather getting worse, they agreed that they might as well hole up there for the night. Sly had been enchanted by a flurry of snow just as the light was finally fading away and had run clumsily around the backyard trying to catch the tumbling flakes in his cupped hands. Jim had found two oil lamps in the largest barn, both nearly filled with kerosene, and they put one in the living room behind the shop. There was a sofa there and one unbroken armchair, enough for them to sit down in reasonable comfort. Carrie hunted around and found a pile of charred wood, already hewn into neat logs. She brought some in and piled them in the hearth, where she soon had a fine blaze going. Kyle took the second brass lamp, lit it, and walked carefully around the devastated store. It broke his heart to see the damage. The first impression was that the place could easily have lived up to its proud boast. The shop was L-shaped, with a door around the corner that opened at the side of the nearest barn. Kyle guessed that the overall size of the store was somewhere about 1,500 square feet. In places, the debris was thigh-deep, with empty and full boxes piled haphazardly. There had been an attempt to burn some of it, but it looked as if it hadn't caught with some inflammable packing material. There were sophisticated camcorders and all sizes of ordinary cameras, mainly 35mm models, with some 25mm, compacts and triple reflex jobs. The owner had installed a small high-def section with the latest image hardware. Hardly anything remained intact. Kyle stooped and picked up a magnificent Hayakawa 3D instant camera, but someone had put his heel through the delicate lens, smashing the crystal glass.
Some coffee, Kyle?
Coffee?
It's wet and very hot and kind of a brown color, Kyle.
Sure. Be right in.
He dropped the Hayakawa amidst the rest of the rubbish. His eye was caught by a tripod at the far end of the store, farthest away from the side door. He picked up the tripod and found a camera still attached to it. It's a Reflex Ryuchi Instant, one of the best available. He set it up, pointing down the length of the shop, making sure it was level. He set the camera's timer for 5 seconds, then positioned himself before the camera and waited. A tiny red eye blinked. Then there was a dazzling flash that made him blink.
What's that? You want help, Kyle?
No thanks. After I've had a drink, I'll take some pics of us all with this.
The image on the screen was perfectly sharp and detailed.
Christ! I look about 100 years old. Every day and every way, I'm getting more and more like my father. Real scary.
Show us.
In a minute. One more.
There was a faint sound from behind him. Kyle turned around, but there was nothing to see in the deep shadows. He reset the camera and posed in front of it, hand on chest, teeth bared in a cheesy grin. There was the same bright starburst flash that seemed to scorch the retina, followed by the sound of the motor. Kyle took a half dozen careful steps toward the camera and stooped to see his image in the screen. There he was, teeth white, head slightly on one side as the timer sprang the shutter release, his bushy hair spreading around his face like a halo. Kyle hadn't realized quite how long it had grown in the past few weeks, and made the decision to ask Carrie to cut it for him before they moved on in the morning. He was beginning to grin at himself when he noticed something else in the photograph. Behind him, in the darkness toward the hidden door, around the corner, something that didn't...
What the...
Kyle looked closer at the background of the picture. It showed an old man in the corner of the room, holding a short, hafted chopping axe, its honed blade catching the silvery gleam of the camera flash. Kyle looked up.
Fucking stealing nigger!
Jim Hilton, .44 caliber in his hand, led the others through the door into the shop, where the flickering light of the oil lamp revealed a horrific scene.
Jesus!
Kyle Lynch was sitting down with his back against the remains of one of the camera store's counters, his legs splayed in front of him, a dark wet patch staining the crotch of his jeans. His eyes were staring blindly in front of him, hands lying in his lap, the fingers knotted together in a rigid grip. There was a massive gash running vertically down the middle of his face, dividing his forehead, crushing his nose, smashing both upper and lower jaws. Blood was flooding from the wound, though across the forehead, Jim could also see the stark ivory gleam of bone. Standing in front of him, gripping a short-handled wood-splitting axe, was a small, elderly white man, bewhiskered and filthy. Carrie was at Jim's heels, Heather right behind her. In the room at their backs, Jim could also hear Sly lumbering to his feet.
What's wrong?
Nigger wrecked my store, was stealing pictures off of me. But I done for him.
The rat-like face turned toward the group in the doorway. Threads of yellowish drool dangled from the man's parted lips into the stained beard.
No!
Part of Jim's mind struggled to reject the unbelievable image of his good friend sprawled on the floor.
I done for the thieving nigger bastard! Give him 40 whacks when I seen what he done!
Oh.
Sly peered over the shoulders of Heather and Carrie.
Now I'll give him 41!
He lifted the axe again above his scrawny shoulder. Jim's finger tightened on the trigger of the Ruger, but the explosion that filled the devastated store wasn't from his revolver. It was from the Smith & Wesson 2050, Kerry Princip's six-shot revolver. The 22 caliber bullet hit the old man through the side of the chest on the right side, making him stagger backward and drop the axe.
Bitch!
He stopped and fumbled for his blood-slick weapon. Kerry put him on his back amidst a scattered pile of old rental videos, his blood spouting all over them.
That does it. Don't waste another one on him.
The old man struggled to sit up as he fought to speak again, but the bullet had nicked his spine, and all the lines were down. He flopped back again, crimson froth mottling his beard. Jim moved quickly to kneel by Kyle Lynch, putting an arm around the slender shoulders.
Christ, man. He's killed me.
Kyle gazed blankly out at some limitless vision of eternity.
Guess he has.
Jim wiped some of the blood off with his sleeve. Kyle was dying in front of them, and there wasn't the smallest hope of doing anything about it.
Want me to pass on any word to your girl, Leanne, if I ever meet her?
No.
He managed a slow shake of the head.
Rosa. It was Rosa. My love. Don't hurt.
Jim felt a slight shift in the body he held and realized that Kyle was gone. As they were getting ready to bury Kyle the next morning, Jim went out into the store where the old man's corpse had already stiffened. One of the movies laying the slobbered under the body was Sunstrokers, the biggest hit his own dead wife Lori starred in. He picked up the video case and stared at the familiar face, speckled with brown stains. Her hair was tied in a garish bandana, and she wore a tiny maroon leather skirt, matching bra top and thigh-length boots. Lori had been so proud of herself in the part, though his own private feelings were, that it wasn't likely to do all that much to advance her acting ambitions. As it turned out, he'd been right. Sunstroker served as both the low spot and the high spot for her career. Jim eyed the copy in rainbow hologram lettering.
Lori Hilton is the Vixen Queen of Bel Air.
He shook his head sadly and dropped the case down alongside the body. Then he went to join the others to ensure a decent burial.
Kyle Lynch, 2015 to 2040. Navigator of USS V Aquila and a good friend.
Heather and Sly worked on the wooden marker driven in at the head of the long pile of dirt. The temperature had dropped, and morning frost speckled the raw earth like sugar dusted on top of a cake. Heather wrote the words out carefully on an invoice from the camera store, and then helped Sly with the painstaking lettering.
Can I say Kyle with Dad? Now they too see me?
No, Nate Sly. We all know that Kyle and Steve are still good friends, where they are now, together.
Carrie's eyes were bright with unshed tears.
Together forever and ever and ever and ever.
Amen to that, Sly.
Heather touched her father gently on the arm.
You feeling all right?
No. Sorry, kitten. But, darling, I find it hard to cope with such endless death.
It'll get better.
I wonder. I look ahead, and all that I can see is a bleak, dark future.
The biting cold northerly ruffled his hair as he stood by the makeshift grave. His face, that of a man who had experienced too much in too short a time. It was hard to decide whether to continue with both their vehicles or cut the losses and crowd together into the one. The paucity of gas figured in Jim Hilton's final decision to dump the oldest 4x4 and press on north toward Eureka in the better truck. He drained what little gas remained and transferred it into the tank. A small bonus was finding a 5-gallon can of gas hidden away behind some sacks in the derelict barn behind the camera store. They hadn't found any food to top off their supply, unless you counted some strips of horse meat dangling from a hook, and so rotten that it seemed to shine with a ghastly pale green phosphorescence, shimmering with the movement of the countless maggots. Then they rolled out, mostly silent in the confines of the car. Around 11, they stopped so that Sly Romero could take a leak. There was a sleety drizzle coming in from the direction of the Pacific, and the other three remained in the comparative warmth of the cab, watching the teenager as he picked his way slowly up the hillside, heading for a clump of stunted, pink-tinted elms that would give him some protection.
He's so sweet.
And brave.
Jim tapped his fingers on the steering wheel.
Got a hard leg of lion.
He said that he wanted to marry me. I told him I thought he was too old for me.
How did he take that?
He smiled and said in that case he guessed he'd have to marry you.
Hey.
Jim wound his window down so that he could see more clearly.
What's wrong with him?
Sly had stopped and looked as if he were trying to hop from foot to foot, waving his hands around his head. He seemed to be shouting.
Can't be hornets or anything like that. Not in the middle of December.
Switch the engine off, Jim.
Carrie had her head on one side, as though she was listening to something.
Truck seems to be sort of vibrating.
As soon as Jim turned the key in the ignition, they were aware of what Sly was shouting.
My feet humming! Help me! My feet humming!
It's a quake!
Jim opened the cab door.
Everyone outside! Quick!
Everything was rattling. The loose wing mirror was visibly shaking, and the ground beneath their feet trembled. On the hillside, there were great pillars of orange-brown dust rising as some of the larger stones and boulders began to work loose. Sly was still agitatedly hopping around, about 150 feet above them.
Come down! You'll be safe if you just get here with us!
I'll help him!
Heather darted away toward the foundering boy.
What should we do?
Carrie was staring around like a tourist being shown a bizarre attraction. The body of the 4x4 was quivering as the vehicle swayed backward and forward on its springs, as if it were being driven over a rock-rippled dirt road.
Try and stay on your feet, I guess! Careful, Heather! Watch out for those big rocks up behind you!
A couple of the dead elms toppled away, their roots rotted by earth blood, and they began to slide ponderously down the slope after Sly and Heather. The rumbling was louder, closing in toward the pain threshold. Jim found it tough to stay upright, fighting for his balance against the liquid earth. The air was filled with dust, and somewhere he was aware that there had been a sound as if the edge had sheared up a tectonic plate, shifting a continent. It was virtually impossible to see anything, and he squeezed his eyes shut.
Jesus, Jim!
Carrie stumbled into him, hanging on as they both fell sideways. Somehow it was worse to be lying down, with the whole length of their bodies in contact with the quaking dirt. But now the movement was so violent there was no alternative. There was only the cold awareness of the reality. The reality that all four were going to die on this lonely blacktop, away in the rural wilds of Northern California, during what was finally going to be the anticipated big one, as the planet shook itself like a hound dog ridding itself of fleas. A savage spasm tore Jim apart from Carrie, and he found himself lying half in a deep irrigation ditch, his feet in cold, brackish water. He caught a glimpse of the 4x4, realizing to his horror that it was being moved by the quake toward him. It slithered sideways like some cunning movie special effect. He wished he could have been cuddling his beloved daughter as death came snarling in to claim both their lives. Blind and deafened, barely able to draw a choking breath, Jim knew this was a fruitless wish. He had only that depressing and lonely thought to take with him into the darkness.
That was a serious mother of a shaker.
Yeah. I reckon the epicenter was probably a couple of hundred miles north of here.
I hate to imagine what kind of damage it must have done up there where we're going.
Nancy Sims joined Jeff, Mac, and Gene McGill, standing on the crest of a rise in the highway. staring away toward the dusty haze that obscured the far north from them.
I never felt anything so strong. At least without power running, there shouldn't be any serious fires. That was always the main threat to life and to property.
You think that Jim and the others, whoever they might be, are somewhere up in the middle of that?
Henderson McGill shaded his eyes, aware of the slight tremor of an aftershock rocking him up onto the balls of his feet.
Sure hope not, Dad.
Paul chewed vigorously on a strip of chili beef.
There's always a very real danger that shifting of the big faults can also trigger some major domino effects.
Like what, Nancy?
Like pressing the start button on one or two of the sleeping volcanoes up that way.
Damn, dust catches your throat. Come on, we won't learn anything by standing here staring like a bunch of boobies. Better get going and try to make the best time we can.
Hope we don't find the highways vanished.
The highway was fine for another 11 miles. Then...
It's fucking vanished! Ah!
Jeff Thomas stood on the brink of the fresh chasm and petulantly kicked a jagged piece of stone over the brink. It clattered down the steep slope and landed in the narrow stream below.
That's very positive, Jefferson.
Nancy Sims stood at his elbow.
Now, if you were to kick in just another 3 million of those pebbles, we could probably pick our way across and continue with our odyssey.
He turned to her, and for a split second, she saw the ruby glow of murderous hatred in his eyes. It disappeared as quickly as it appeared, but she knew it always burned there, and that one day she would have to do something about it. Ignoring it for the time being, she flashed him an ironic smile and joined the others. It was time to abandon the phantasm. Pamela had noticed the engine running hot since the previous afternoon, and it looked as if the bearings were going too. Also, the vacuum brakes needed pumping before hitting a serious downgrade, and even then seemed sluggish. Now, confronted by the totally blocked road, it seemed that the end had come for it. It meant a division of everything between the 4x4 and the Jeep towing the fuel tank.
Hardly worth keeping that going. By the time we divide up the remaining gas, it'll about fill the two tanks with a spit and a dribble left over.
Agreed, Mac?
Sure. Whatever you think best.
Guns can be divided, as well as the food and what clothes we can carry.
Paul shook his head.
Shame. Gonna have to dump an awful lot of stuff that Jean and Angel packed up for us back home.
Can't we trade it, Daddy? Mommy said when we were leaving home that if we ran into hard times, we could trade some things.
Ah, great idea. Well done, sweetie. Brilliant.
He swung the girl off her feet and gave her a hug and a kiss.
Ugh, you're awful bristly.
McGill looked around at the others.
Just ask me who's got the brightest little girl in the world. What's left of the world, and I'll tell you.
No.
How's that?
We don't try and trade what's left. We burn out the phantasm with everything inside it as soon as we're ready to move on. Take what we can first.
Why the fuck not?
Jean stepped forward, jaw thrust out, hands on hips.
Come on, lady. Think about it for a moment. We're not dealing with a garage sale in downtown Tulsa. This is now. We go along in that big RV to the nearest community and offer them the stuff we don't want. What do?
They look at us and think about what kind of gear we aren't selling. There's a half dozen of us and maybe 50 or 100 of them.
We got guns.
Come on, child. You've lived through Earth blood and traveled clear across the continent, and you don't seem to me to have learned squat from it.
Mac put Jocelyn down.
Surely we could do some sort of trade without running too big a risk, Nancy. Shame to waste it all.
She ticked off the points on her gloved fingers.
One, it isn't a question of the degree of risk. We're talking dead or not dead, Mac. Two, we'll strip everything we can carry from the RV and jam it in the Jeep or our truck. Won't be much useful waste. Three, time's passing, so let's get on with it.
No one said anything after that. They set about transferring from the RV what they needed to keep, then set fire to the vehicle.
Seems there's always fires these days.
As Mac and the girls climbed into the Jeep with her, Jean watched the blazing inferno that had been their home. Pamela and Paul were with Jeff and Nancy in the 4x4. They would lead them back along the same highway to search for a route that would take them around the worst effects of the quake and allow them to pick up another road north. They had a hard time of it. It seemed that every single route they found that looked as if it might lead in the general direction they wanted was eventually blocked. The roads ended in a massive fall of thousands of tons of rock and dirt, or in a bridge ripped from its foundations, or a diverted river that foamed across the original blacktop. A 2-mile stretch of straight highway had been rippled like cooling toffee into hundreds of ridges steep enough to make it impassable. By the dawning of December 18th, they stood on the bank of the swollen Hay Fork River. From there, they hoped to work their way northwest onto Highway 299. That would, if all went well, eventually bring them down into their destination of Eureka, a few miles south from Arcata.
Present rate of progress means we'll be damn good to get to the rendezvous by Christmas Day. Never mind later today.
Max spat into the muddy water of the river.
Guess there don't seem to be many folks around here. Real nowhere, really.
Plenty of goats.
Late on the previous afternoon, Jeff had been at the wheel of the 4x4, leading the Jeep by 100 yards or so, when he spotted a herd of black and white goats wandering along the unfenced road.
Geronimo!
He put his foot down so hard that Nancy had banged her head on the side window, where she'd been snatching a few minutes of sleep. The animals had seemed dazed, as though they'd already forgotten that vehicles could be dangerous. One or two ran off into the surrounding brush. But most stood their ground, including a ferocious, long-bearded billy goat, who actually dipped his head as though he was going to charge the powerful truck.
Yeah!
Jeff jumped out to see how successful he'd been. They all worked into the evening on skinning and dismembering the half-dozen youngest, tenderest goats, throwing the offal out into the darkness for the predatory coyotes they'd heard every night for weeks.
I done good, Nancy.
Jeff whispered into her ear as they awaited rest and sleep that night. Every one of them was sated and stuffed from a stomach-bursting surfeit of the delicious pale meat.
You done excellently, Jefferson.
I earn a reward.
She'd smiled and let her hand slip inside his shirt, inching across his chest until it touched his nipple. She gripped it between finger and thumb and squeezed, gently, then firmly, then hard, kissing him on the mouth to stifle his low moan of pain. Then nipping his lower lip between her sharp teeth until blood trickled down his chin. Then she had withdrawn a little bit from him.
That's a down payment on the reward, Jeff. Guess what the rest'll be?
I can't, Nancy.
Yes, you can. It's gonna be on the tip of your tongue, Jeff. I think you know what I mean.
He got what she meant. Progress was agonizingly slow, even with the off-road capacity of both their vehicles. By the morning of the 19th, they still hadn't even reached Highway 299. Paul McGill was the best at navigation, and his most optimistic guess still only put them around 15 miles off the junction.
Means we can't hope to reach Eureka until the evening of the 20th.
He paused to take in their disappointed expressions. Then, so that no false hopes would be nurtured, he added,
at the earliest.
Jim Hilton kicked the front wheel of the silent, motionless truck.
Can't be more than a dozen miles and we run out of gas. Hellfire and bloody perdition.
It was late morning on December 18th, the day after the huge earthquake that came so desperately close to killing all of them. Jim had recovered consciousness to find the earth still thrumming beneath him, the dust shifting across the spread fingers of his right hand. The 4x4 hung over the side of the irrigation ditch where he lay, one wheel spinning silently, only a few inches above his head. There was a high-pitched sound drilling through his brain, as though a cheerful maniac who lived inside one of the abandoned back rooms of the west wing of his skull was busy sawing apart sheets of plate glass. He winced, and then reluctantly opened his eyes again. There was also shouting. A woman's voice, he thought. Lori? No.
Shut up, Sly, and help me find Dad!
It was Heather. Heather finally managed to reassure the terrified boy that the world hadn't ended in the cataclysm of noise and whirling dust, and quickly discovered Jim lying under the threat of the 4x4. Carrie had also been thrown off the highway, into the same ditch farther along. She had strained her wrist and was bruised and battered from shoulder to ankle. It took all four of them, working carefully together, to tease the truck back to safety. Heather sat in the driving seat with the engine running, ready to put it into gear as soon as Jim gave her the word. He and Carrie and Sly gathered at the rear end of the 4x4, heaving and shoving. The boy proved invaluable in the difficult exercise, constantly eager to give of his considerable best, bracing his shoulder against the dusty metal. Now, like Pilgrim within sight of his fabled destination, they stood short by a handful of miles. They sat by the now useless vehicle, sharing a large dented can of apricots. Food was also in short supply.
Think anyone else could be there before us?
Jim licked his lips, catching the sweet syrup, wondering vaguely whether one of his crowns was working loose. There'd been a couple of ominous stabs of pain in the past couple of days, and he guessed that good dentists were going to be few and far between.
We don't know if there is an anyone else to get here.
I reckon that Mac will pull through, especially with Pete to help him.
I think that the old woman will turn up to haunt us all.
Heather ran a finger around the inside of the empty can and licked it.
Wouldn't bet against her. Guess we'll just have to wait and see.
What we doing now, Captain Jim?
Sly smiled eagerly, knowing that Jim would come up with a good idea. He always did.
Walk down toward the sea, Sly.
See the sea, I see the sea, and the sea see me.
Hope you're still in good spirits after a long walk, Sly.
I like walk, kitten.
Jim waited for his daughter to snap angrily at the lad for using the endearment that she hated so much, but she said nothing to Sly. Gary stood up and kicked the can over the edge of the highway, down into a barren field.
Doesn't seem much point in taking trash home with us these days.
Reckon we could come close to Eureka before the day's done.
Cold and clammy kind of day.
Gary hugged herself.
This part of the coast gets a lot of fog and rain.
Jim glanced at his watch.
High noon, people. Packs on backs and guns ready to hand. Let's move on.
The weather deteriorated as the afternoon wore on, making it necessary to keep referring to the compass Jim carried. The land was folded and tilted by the quakes, and every now and again it would twitch in the memory of an aftershock. Each time that happened, Sly would settle in closer to Heather, hesitantly taking her hand. The fog thickened, swirling around them, distorting perspectives and bringing a greater caution, along with the fear of what might be lingering in the farther gray edge of the coils of mist, waiting to snap them up. The taste of salt was on everybody's lips.
I'm tired, Captain Jim.
Sly stopped and sat himself down in the middle of the blacktop.
Yeah, me too, son. Think you can go a little farther? Get off the highway and find us a good place to camp for the night. Then we can move on fresh into Eureka in the morning. Can't be more than 2 miles now.
Nearer five, friend.
Who the...
The voice seemed to waft from the banks of fog. Jim swung around and drew the Ruger in mid-motion, realizing as he did how useless a gesture that was if the speaker already had a weapon trained on him.
Now, don't go popping off with that cannon you got there, friend. Might just hurt someone means you no harm.
You got a name, mister?
Sure. Dorian Langford. Retired editor. Textbook school stuff. Widower.
I'm Jim Hilton. Got my daughter here and a couple of other friends.
Good to meet you.
Come on ahead out of the fog, Mr. Langford.
If I was a gambling man, Jim, which I might tell you that I used to be, I'd probably lay odds of around 7-2 that you're a decent man.
Fair odds. Prefer 2-1.
Well. Now Jim could just make the man out, standing on a rise in the ground about 30 yards away, like a half-glimpsed statue in a misty park.
Since that bloody plant cancer tipped everything downside up, I've been mainly on the move. Got a cabin a few miles away, but I don't live there. Stay in one place in this benighted land, and you get killed, Jim. You notice that?
Sure have, Mr. Langford. You know these parts well, then? We're aiming to head northward.
On foot? As much chance as me becoming Pope. That big trembler did some serious harm. Sea broken away north of Eureka. Backed up rivers. Flooded thousands of miles of lowland.
How do we get around it, then? Are there boats in Eureka?
Sure. And food, gas, drugs, women, men, little children. These days you can find most anything you want in Eureka. And a lot of firearms, lady.
It seemed as if their hopeful plans for a meeting at the nearby town were in ruins.
How do they greet strangers, Mr. Langford?
Name's Dorian, Jim. How do they greet strangers? Like this. Just like that.
Sure you won't come in for the night, Dorian? We don't have much, but... what we've got, you're welcome to share.
Perhaps 2-1 would be better odds, Jim. But I'll go on a spell.
Sure. Good luck, Dorian.
Thanks.
Something that could have been a hand waved at them from out of the darkening mist.
Hey, one other thing.
What's that?
Been hearing about a place up towards Seattle way called Aurora.
Sly opened his mouth, then closed it again as Heather hastily put her finger to her lips.
I think I've heard the name.
You aren't so hot when it comes to being economical with the truth. But I'm a nosy old bugger, and your business is your business.
You hear where it was?
No, Jim, sorry. But I hear enough to make me think it could be a good place. I'd seek it out myself sometime.
Sure.
Oh, and I heard some other folks asking around for Aurora. Way I hear it, the odds against them being nice folks might be in the region of 1,000 to 1. Or even longer than that. So y'all, take care.
Will do. You too.
The figure was gone. The Blizzard Center was less than 40 miles away from where Jim Hilton and the others camped for that night before making the last push through toward Eureka. But it trapped the McGill party in its whiteout heart. They were there for the evening and night of the 18th, right through the 19th into the 20th. Almost the only good that came out of the Earthblood Plague was the astounding amount of dead wood that lay everywhere. At times it seemed as if the whole land was one gigantic tangle of brittle, broken branches for burning.
Normal times, and we could have found ourselves in a rather perilous situation.
Nancy sat close to the fire, her boots tucked behind her to avoid the heat damaging them.
At least we shall not be required to pay attendance at the deathly court of King Hypothermia.
Huh? Sometimes it sounds like you swallowed a whole dictionary, Nancy.
It used to be called educated, young ignoramus.
Now don't get to calling my children names, Nancy, or you and I'll fall out.
Jean warmed her hands at the blaze, careful not to meet the other woman's eyes, so that Nancy couldn't see how frightened she was of her.
Wouldn't want that, Jean. Not at all. Good thing about this weather is that it means the Hunters of the Sun can't hope to track us down. The longer we keep away and the farther north we get, the safer we can feel.
You think they'll chase me, Nancy?
The heat brought out the livid scar from Jeff's right eye to the corner of his mouth, making it flush crimson. He was conscious of it, and kept tracing the welt with his finger.
Possibly. Depends on what the chief might think you know. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes if she believed you'd held back information.
He winced at the threat, even though Nancy softened it by stroking a finger down his cheek. Mac leaned back.
I guess things could be worse. At least we're all together and safe for the time being. Warm. Enough gas to get us away farther. Food. And a fine scene like a Christmas card.
God bless us, everyone. That's out of a book by Dickens about Christmas.
Think that there'll be anyone off the Aquila in the town, Dad?
If Jim Hilton says a place and a time, then there's only one thing that'll stop him from being there.
What stops him, Daddy?
Suki frowned with the effort of trying to follow the strange convolutions of the adult's conversation.
Big man in a black cloak, honey, with a sharp scythe over his shoulder.
How about a gang of paramilitaries with a golden arrow and a silver sun on their uniforms. How about the Hunters of the Sun, Mac?
Comes to about the same thing as a man with a scythe, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right, Mac.
It took 3 days for the underground message from Dorian Langford to reach the desk of General Zelig. At last, he had a real clue to the possible location of some of the missing crew of the USSV Aquila. But by then, the events had moved on at such a rate that the information was obsolete. However, it enabled him to shift the location of one of his white pins. He stuck it carefully into the coast of California, near where there'd been several reports of serious earthquake activity, close to the town of Eureka. In the cold, misty weather that prevailed, with flurries of snow riding in off the sullen rollers of the Pacific, Heather Hilton looked like any other child in Eureka. Huddled inside a quilted anorak, the hood pulled over her face, she found it easy to slip through the indifferent guards. The rusting roadblocks had been there for far too long, the handful of men on duty lazy and careless. Heather simply walked 100 yards or so into the flat fields, climbed over a single fence, and was inside the suburbs of the township. It had been her own idea to go in. Jim opposed it from the start, though Carrie took the girl's side.
Nobody will notice one more kid. You or me will stand out like a flare at midnight. We need to know if there are boats and what their security is like. Heather's best fitted to do that, Jim.
Reluctantly, he had agreed. She was back about 2 hours later, in the middle of the morning of the 20th day of December, scrambling noisily between the dead elm trees and the small grove on the southwestern outskirts of Eureka, the place they picked for their camp.
It's me, Dad. Heather.
He almost crushed her as he swung her clean off her feet. The boy had been frightened when she disappeared earlier in the day, unable to understand where she went or what she was doing. His disturbance added to Jim Hilton's own doubts.
All right, Sly. I'm back safe. You can put me down on the ground now.
It was the first time that any of them had actually been inside a reasonably large township since Earthblood, and the girl's report was profoundly depressing.
Just a shambles, Dad.
The effects of the virulent plant cancer had been almost as catastrophic for the oceans as on the land, killing off the various algae and seaweeds that provided the basic nutrients for the food chains to function. For a community like Eureka, based on the water, mere survival was almost too much.
All look like they're starving. Raggedy, thin. Saw a man dying in the street and folks walked over him like he wasn't there. Been a real big fire some time back. Whole sections blackened and gone. Everyone carries a gun of some sort.
How about the boats, Heather?
Oh yeah, the boats.
Snow fell in the afternoon, leaving a clean layer across the drab, dead land. Sly had been softly stamping around and around, treading a circle in the mud, humming to himself. Jim explained to him that they were going to go and find a boat, and then sail away or row away, knowing that the chances of finding a powered vessel were nil, and that they must all keep very quiet, like a hiding game. Sly nodded, showing he understood. Now, as he tramped around the grove, Jim could hear the little song that the boy was chanting.
We're going to wait for dark, Jim?
I reckon the guards might be more careful then. That's the time you'd expect some sort of trouble. I figured to make our move late afternoon. Then if we can get a little way out of the land, it'll soon be dark and they won't have too much chance to get themselves organized and come after us.
Will there be killing, Dad?
I hope not.
Heather looked at her father.
I can tell. You think there will be, don't you?
Maybe. I truly hope not. Killing's just craft, like any other, honey. You have to learn it. Learn how to kill some father's son, some mother's daughter. If we're lucky, we can sneak in and take a boat without anyone spotting us.
When the time came for them to set off, the skies had cleared, and the temperature had dropped way below freezing. Far off to the west, the sun was already dipping its brazen head beneath the horizon of the Pacific. The air was filled with the scent of cooking fires. The long shadows stretched eastward. A frost dusted the narrow path that Jim had selected for their cautious advance toward the cluster of small boats on the seaward flank of Eureka. Most of them were less than 12 feet long and seemed frail to take out onto the sea. A few of them were much bigger, with tall masts and furled sails. Jim was tempted by them, but he knew little about working boats and guessed that the larger vessels would take longer to get underway and might present terminal problems for two adults and the two teenagers to manage. Once they were irrevocably committed to stealing one of the boats, failure would mean death. Also, he suspected that the smaller ones might be less well guarded. They walked in single file, their breath hazing the darkening air about them. Jim led, with Sly on his heels, closely followed by Heather. Carrie brought up the rear. Jim and Carrie agreed that this was a make-or-break situation.
No hesitating or turning back.
Kill or be killed.
They said nothing further until Jim stopped, peering around the corner of a long, single-story warehouse. The town seemed quiet. The sun was halfway down, and the water was calm, with small wavelets lapping at the crusted wood of the piers. There were three men on watch. Two stood together, smoking on the main dockside. The third was walking slowly up and down on one of the maze of narrow jetties, closer to the open Pacific. All had rifles slung over shoulders.
Follow close.
Jim held his arms around Sly and Heather, feeling his daughter trembling with either fear or excitement.
We walk straight to that man on his own, like we have a right. Hoods up and don't look at him. Closer we get before he spots us as strangers, the better chance we got. Soon as he goes down, you two hop into the boat and Carrie'll untie it.
What about those other two, Dad? Won't they be able to see what's happening?
While you all get into one of the rowing boats, I'll deal with them.
I see the sea.
The phrase seemed to be Sly's mantra for good luck. The McGill party sat around a small campfire close to a low headland overlooking the sea. Day was almost done, and they decided to wait before venturing down into Eureka. Nancy held up a hand to silence the group.
What is it? You heard something, Nancy?
Yeah. Three shots from a big handgun. Spaced out. One, and then two more.
Things did not go quite how Captain James Hilton had hoped they would. They got onto the jetty, feeling the slow surge and swell of the water against the old creaking timbers. The two men standing together hadn't even looked around. Jim had peered into the first boats they passed, seeing, to his relief, that all of them seemed to have a couple of sets of oars in them. To cut the risks, he wanted to get away from the farthest end of the pier, giving less time for any attack from the land.
Hey there, neighbor! Fine evening it is.
The lone man betrayed no hint of suspicion. Jim nodded.
Cole, though!
Who's that, Jerry?
The question came from behind them and to their right, where one of the other men had suddenly taken an interest in the foursome.
Why, who the fuck are you, neighbor?
He began to unsling the rifle. Jim had his hand on the walnut grips of the Ruger inside his jacket, precisely ready for this moment. The range was 20 feet, farther than he wanted to open the shooting, but the guard was silhouetted against the fiery light of the sun. The full metal jacket round knocked him backward, where he tripped over the edge of the pier.
In the boat, now!
Jim dropped to one knee, right arm straight, steadied with his left hand. He sighted on the pair of sentries, around 30 paces away from him, their backs to the whitewashed wall of a warehouse. They both reached for their hunting rifles, fumbling in a panic at the shocking sight of their colleague butchered in front of them. Two perfect shots. It was just like being on the shooting range, aiming for winners, with a round of drinks depending on it.
Damn.
Jim saw the men fall. The wall behind them sprayed with two vivid splashes of arterial blood, doubly red in the sunlight. Carrie struggled with a knot in the thick, damp rope.
Damn knot! Come on! Got it!
She finally freed it from the smooth bollard. Heather was sitting in the bow. Sly slumped on the next thwart along. Jim was about to jump in when he realized that he'd messed it all up.
Heather, take the tiller and steer us. Sly in the front. Carrie, sit where he was, and I'll take this pair of oars at the back.
There was instant confusion. The boat wobbled from side to side, but Jim managed to grab his hand and steady him.
Oh me, oh me, oh me.
You're fine. Sit down and keep still, Sly.
Heather was far more nimble, sitting at the stern, hand on the tiller. Carrie put her oars into the oarlocks while Jim was still trying to get his in place.
Hey! What are you doing? Get back here!
Son of a bitch! Right! Let's go!
Fortunately, his daughter had the sense to realize that the two adults needed guidance in keeping time with each other.
Stroke! Stroke! Stroke!
The water whirled under the blades of the oars. Jim had the exhilarating feeling of movement.
Hey, kids! We're off!
They were clear of the end of the jetty, the girl steering out to sea, putting as much distance as possible between them and the shore.
Hey, where are you going?
I found the bodies!
Facing backward, Jim could see what was happening. The setting sun behind them painted the town blood red, showing a number of men scrambling toward the rest of the boats, but were less than 100 yards off. A rifle cracked, but Jim couldn't tell where the bullet went.
Keep rowing!
He shipped his oars and glanced over his shoulder to see to his relief that the sun was almost completely gone. Full darkness was moments away. He drew the Ruger. He tried to allow for the movement of the rowboat as it encountered larger waves. A man went down, and they saw with great satisfaction that the rest of them dove for cover, abandoning their attempts to get more boats launched. He tucked the empty gun in his belt and resumed rowing, pulling with all his strength, wishing for a moment that Henderson McGill was there to help them with his powerful muscles. But more shots from the shore, one kicking up a tiny fountain of spray only a yard from the starboard side of the boat, concentrated his mind most wonderfully. They were now close on 300 yards out, moving smoothly into the crimson trail of the sun.
Keep us straight out. Head north in a few minutes.
We safe?
I believe we are, for the time being.
There were no more shots. Nancy watched Mac's face as he stared through the glasses at the tiny boat disappearing without pursuit, toward the ruby blur of the dying sun, going into the darkness of the far west.
Is it?
Yeah.
Miguel lowered the binoculars.
Yeah, it is.
It was a starry night. Jim carried on rowing for another quarter hour or so, after Sly Romero finally gave up. The lad battled bravely, the oars rising and falling steadily as the boat made its slow way north. But eventually he began to cry.
It's hurt, Jim.
Now they were drifting. Heather was curled up in the bow, her head pillowed on her arms. A sliver of moon peered through the rack of high cloud, making her face look as pale as death. Carrie was also asleep, her head resting on the forward thwart, one arm hanging over the side of the boat, fingertips nearly trailing in the cold water. Sly was sitting with his back to Jim, locked into that half-world between wakefulness and sleep, staring out over the stern, toward the south, where the faint lights of Eureka had long disappeared. There was a bank of thin mist clinging to the black surface of the sea, about a half-mile away to the west. Jim lay back and rested, watching it, aware that he needed to exercise extreme caution for the next few hours. If the fog came closer and thickened, then it would only be too easy to lose all sense of direction. They had no compass in the boat, and it would be frighteningly simple to row strongly out toward the far horizon instead of trying to keep reasonably close into shore. Jim also knew that the coast of Northern California was notorious for dangerous currents and treacherous changes in the weather, but for now he felt fairly secure. He was trying to recall from his fast-fading memory some of the main celestial patterns in the sky. It had been at least 9 years ago, at the beginning of his space training, when Ursa Major and Orion and Betelgeuse and Cygnus and Hydra were all familiar to him, along with hundreds of other stars and constellations.
Delphinus? Draco over there? Shit, I don't know.
As he struggled with his memory, another thought fought its way into his mind. Here, in this Earthblood-cursed world, all of his qualifications and expertise as a leading officer in the United States space program were now of less value than his ability to kill other human beings with a big Ruger holstered at his hip. Sly was asleep now, doubled over, his large head resting on his hands. Jim was astounded at the lad's resilience, wondering what he must have made of the past few weeks of his life. To be ripped away from his mother, Allison, though that was probably not much hardship, and then exposed to so much death. The deaths of his father, and then his good and trusted friend, Kyle Lynch. Jim also wondered what might have happened to the rest of his command. How many were still alive?
If any.
The rocking of the boat made him feel sleepy, but he fought against it, digging his fingernails into his cheeks, pinching himself hard, until tears watered his eyes. The stranger from the mist. What was his name? Dorian Langford, the widowed publisher of school textbooks. He'd said the big quakes had devastated the land to the north, severing virtually all communication by land. Thousands of acres flooded as the sea broke inland. Jim had seen some old films of the catastrophic disaster of the early 90s, clear over the Midwest, when months of rain inundated tens of thousands of square miles all across the valleys of the Missouri and the Mississippi. It was an eco-holocaust that took the region 30 years to recover from. It had finally just about gotten back on course when Earthblood struck. If the cautious Mr. Langford was right, then it might involve a long ocean journey in the frail little rowboat before they could once again find dry land and resume the quest toward Aurora. The swaying movement of the little boat was languorous, the chuckle of water rippling under the keel, lulling Jim Hilton toward sleep. It was a beautiful, sunny morning. In the hills above the reservoir, less than a half mile from the Hollywood sign, Jim was standing in the heated pool of his home on Tahoe Drive. The twins, Andrea and Heather, were in the family room just off the patio, rehearsing a playlet to be performed at their school in a few days, just before Easter. They wore frilled bathing costumes, Andrea's vivid green, and Heather's a startling blood red. Jim leaned on the hot stones and smiled up into the cloudless sky. This was about as close to perfect happiness as the gods allowed you to get. Rory came out of the cool depths of the house, sliding back the almost invisible screen door. She carried a large white tray, carefully picking her way around the girls.
Hi, sweetheart.
Jim waved to her, sending spreading ripples across the turquoise pool.
Looks good.
Me or the food?
Both, of course.
Lori was wearing a tiny bikini in white satin, setting off her long blonde hair.
Feel hungry?
After glancing around over her shoulder to make sure both the girls were safely preoccupied, Lori came very close to him. She squatted down, deliberately spreading her perfect thighs inches from his face.
Very. Got all my juices running.
Better tuck into this first, big boy, before it gets cold.
Wouldn't want it getting cold.
He moved one dripping hand from the water toward her.
Hey, what about little eyes?
She gestured to the twins.
Later is better. Wish you may, wish you might.
Lori put the tray down, and Jim saw the big plate brimming with delicious food. 5 thick patties of Canadian bacon, pink and crisp-edged, a splash of ketchup like clotted blood at their center, a cloudburst of scrambled eggs cooked to perfection, dusted with salt and pepper, 2 tomatoes sliced in half, and a heap of lightly fried mushrooms, a portion of veal, tender and just a little underdone, with a mist of pink clinging to its edges, some link sausages, jostling a Matterhorn of hash browns. There were some baked beans surrounding an island of green chili, a steak sat in one corner of the plate, with a haunch of sea bass next to it. A pile of shell pasta was sprinkled with grated basil. Huevos Ranchero sat waiting for him in the middle of the platter, nudging a whole lobster.
Good.
Not too much?
Never have too much. You coming in the pool? Or do you want to come somewhere else?
You and your dirty mouth quite disgust me, James Hilton.
But her smile contradicted her words.
So everyone is blowing bubbles.
That was the punchline to the kids' sketch for the school, and was totally incomprehensible to their parents. Lori slipped into the crystal water, hardly disturbing the placid surface, moving in a few languid strokes to the far deep end.
Come over here, honey.
There was a frosted pitcher of fresh squeezed orange juice, along with a decanter of cranberry juice, tart on the tongue, its color rich as fresh spilled blood. As she started to swim slowly toward him, the sun was veiled, and a cold wind rattled the storm shutters. Jim shuddered, hunching his shoulders. The sparkle went off the surface of the pool, and it became clouded and dull.
What's happening?
The sliding screen door slammed shut, and both the girls had disappeared from the family room. The water in the swimming pool took on the color of pewter. Jim knew there was a delicate whirling pattern in scarlet and crimson mosaics at the bottom, but it had become invisible. Lori had stopped swimming and stood up, barely in her depth, the surface of the gray liquid only a couple of inches below her chin. Her blue eyes were wide and frightened.
Jim, help me!
Jim glanced at the tray. Though only a few seconds had passed, the food had rotted. Everything had turned into a disgusting sludge of green-gray putrescence, covered in thin white worms and fat, leprous maggots. He turned toward his wife again, and his jaw dropped.
Lori!
She had vanished. Jim nearly went under himself, as the depth of water in the pool seemed to increase dramatically. Now it was as if he were swimming in the middle of the sea, with 1,000 feet of sullen ocean below him. He felt something immeasurably huge move by, only a few yards beneath his feet. Lori! Lori! It took Jim a few moments to reassert his hold on reality. They were all still safe in the rowboat, the gray Pacific around them glittering under the cold moonlight. He noticed at once that Carrie had changed position in sleep, her right hand and lower arm now dangling in the water. And a few yards away, moving toward them, was a huge shark. Nancy returned to the others, emerging from the feeble moonlight, holding the Heckler & Koch, the Port Royal machine pistol slung across her shoulders.
Jesus! You made me jump. Never heard you coming.
You wouldn't, Mac.
The others had been dozing in sleeping bags, but all of them, except for Suki and Jocelyn, came out to hear what the woman had to report.
Was it Hilton?
Most likely. They killed three of the good people of Eureka and wounded another. From the sound of the shooting, it was Jim's Ruger that did the business. Must say I'm impressed with his marksmanship. I overheard the talk, and it seems he killed the three guards on the boats with his first three shots.
How do you know it was Jim?
Sturdy, middle-aged man, woman with blonde hair, young girl, and a teenager who seemed a mite clumsy.
Sounds like Jim and Carrie, for sure. So they got away north in the boat, did they? You figure why they did that, Nancy? Run out of fuel, maybe?
I don't know. Surely there's gas in a town like this, unless they tried for it and failed. Don't know. I wonder whether these quakes have blotted out the highways north. Could even be the seas come in.
How the fuck do we find out? We got so close to being with them again.
We don't find out, Jefferson. I do. I'm going in to ask some questions. I'll be back in a couple of hours. I want everyone ready to move when I come back.
Move where?
Jim Hilton reckoned the best bet was a boat. He could be right. I'll find out. Scout the harbor. They won't look for another raid in the same night.
As quickly and silently as she'd appeared, the woman vanished again. Nancy was right. The shooting and the theft of one of the 12-foot rowboats had left the settlement in a state of shock. There was a movement among some of the younger men for sending out one of their bigger sailing vessels after the killers, but caution won out. With three corpses to be readied for burial on the morrow and wounds to be tended, nobody gave a lot of thought to protecting the remaining vessels. As a token gesture, one of the teenage boys, Nathan Gambon, was ordered out. He was given a 9mm Lama Omni automatic, one of the best handguns in the whole township, to overcome his moaning about being given the chore. Now, Nathan was sitting on the end of the jetty, practicing drawing and cocking the gun, the checkered plastic grips firm in his hand. The moon was sinking behind a bank of thicker cloud, and the ocean was dark as pitch. Nathan's father promised that someone would come out to relieve him on watch, but his father had been intending to bury a cask of homebrew with some friends, and Nathan wasn't too optimistic about his ability to recall the promise. The night was bitingly cold, and the lad turned up the collar of his borrowed parka, huddling down into the warm quilted material.
You look lonely, son.
Nathan shot around like a startled rabbit, jumping to his feet, holding the gun at the end of his outstretched arm.
Who the...
Instantly, he felt a little foolish when he saw that it was a stooped elderly woman. The rest of the pier was deserted.
Oh, what do you want?
A little talk, son.
Yeah, that's... I don't know you, do I?
Just passing through Eureka. Why not put that big cannon away, son?
No, I'm... Ow!
He never saw her move, but his right wrist felt as if someone had chopped it in half with an axe. His fingers opened, and the gun dropped to the damp planking, bouncing once before plopping over the side. The old woman didn't seem so stooped anymore, and was standing close to him.
That hurt! And the gun's gone, and...
There was a sudden gripping pain in his groin as her fingers clawed shut around his testicles, freezing the breath in his lungs. The pain was blinding, and tears coursed down his cheeks. Slowly, he was being drawn up, forced to rise to the tips of his toes to try to avoid being gelded.
Quietly. No noise. There's a good boy. I'll not take a moment.
What?
She released her hold a little, letting him settle back on his feet.
Is there a highway open north?
Of course not. Lots of quakes, lady. Lake's 100 miles across, a ways north of town.
So the only way is by boat?
I heard you could loop east, but it'd take at least days to do that.
The pain had melted from white agony to a raw red throbbing.
Good. That's all the questions I have.
But...
Nancy used the heel of her left hand in a stabbing, snapping blow upward. It hit Nathan below the nose, driving his head back. He lost consciousness and fell to the ground as the woman let go of his genitals. She stooped at his side, pressed finger and thumb to the slowly throbbing artery beneath the left ear, and held it until all movement ceased. Before leaving the jetty, Nancy rolled the corpse into the harbor, where it made only a small splash. In less than an hour, she was back again, leading the six McGills and Jeff. Everyone was carrying blankets and food and water and weapons. Suki wandered sleepily along, holding the hand of her brother Paul. The other hand trailed her favorite doll, mournful Meg. Nancy hadn't explained to them what she'd been doing. She simply said that she'd found the roads were washed out to the north and that they had to steal a boat. Nobody asked her what she'd done to find that out. They found no sentry on the jetty.
What kind are we taking?
No need to whisper, Jefferson. You heard the noise from their alehouse. They're having a wake for the dead, making enough din to rouse the dead.
But what kind of boat, Nancy?
You keep pushing me with your damn fool questions, and you'll finish up with a Mexican necktie.
Well, what's that?
Cut open the front of your throat and slice the tendon under your tongue. Pull the tongue down and out the slit in your neck. Understand me, Jefferson?
Yeah, Nancy, I understand.
Mac was standing near the edge of the narrow pier, looking at the boats all around, when he spotted the body of a young man, arms spread, floating belly up, white-eyed, in among the barnacle timbers. He decided not to mention it to anyone, and moved toward Paul and the boat Nancy was looking over.
We have two adult males, three if you feel able to include Jefferson Lee Thomas, I have my own doubts. There is myself, Pamela, and also Jean, who strikes me as being a capable person. The rowboats are obviously too small.
She pointed at the vessel with the muzzle of the Port Royal, which had somehow appeared in her fingers. The boat was called the Eureka Bell and was 40 feet long. There had once been an auxiliary engine, but that had rusted away. There was a tall mast that carried both a mainsail and a spinnaker in dark green canvas. Nancy went to the stern and took the wheel.
Mac, loose the bow cable!
Without being told, Paul went to free the rear line from the frost-slick bollard. Suki and Jocelyn were taken below by their mother, who reappeared on deck to report that there were 8 bunks in 2 separate rooms.
Fine. Jeff, get ready to haul that rope there. Jean, you help him. Pamela, can you go below decks and keep an eye on the little ones, no knowing what trouble they might get into? The bow line goes first, Mac. Push her off and jump. Don't leave it too late. We won't be coming back for anyone. Then drop your rope, Paul. And move fast to get on board. Everyone knows what's happening?
Nobody answered.
Why do I bother, I wonder? Let's do it, people!
It was a perfect departure. The ship ghosted gently away from her berth, and both Mac and his only surviving son managed to scramble on board without too much trouble.
Hoist the mainsail!
The big sail began to inch its way up the mast.
Ha ha. I recall some poem about going to the sea again.
She tested the feel of the wheel.
With laughing fellow rovers. But let it pass.
The water bubbled away behind the Eureka Bell as Nancy set a course due west, chasing the long-gone sunset. There was no alarm, no attempt at a chase, no shooting. It was the perfect getaway. Jean joined Pamela and the girls below decks to sleep, followed by Paul, and within the hour, Jeff Thomas. Mac remained on the deck, leaning on the rail, watching the casually competent way that the older woman handled the ship.
Reckon you could do this on your own, couldn't you, Nancy?
If I had to, Mac.
Big boat like this?
Not too difficult. She's been set up so that one person can sail her in calm weather. If the wind rose or the sea got rough, then it would take 2, probably 3.
You've done this sort of thing before?
She smiled at him, her even teeth gleaming in the fading moonlight.
I've done most things before, Mac, and been most places. Sailed as a little sprat with my father off Pawtucket Sound up in New England.
The wake was straight as an ebony ruler, leading back toward the invisible bulk of the land. Mac breathed in, savoring the clean taste of the sea.
Good.
Beats most pleasures.
She glanced up at the leading edge of the mainsail and made a slight adjustment to the helm.
Wind's freshening and veering a couple points southerly. Help us on our way.
To catch Jim and the others?
Strength in numbers, Mac. Especially when you're all strangers in this strange new land.
I read that.
Nancy looked sideways at him.
Then you know where the quote comes from.
Of course. I used to read all the science fiction going. It's Robert Heinlein.
Sure, Mac. But he got it out of the Bible from the book of Exodus. The 22nd verse of the 2nd chapter.
You know the good book real well.
The sail fluttered, and Mac was conscious that they'd picked up a little more speed.
The Bible. I was once in a prison cell in Colombia under sentence of death for 3 months. Tidal water flooded it up to 6 inches from the ceiling morning and evening. Then the crabs came in, big as dinner plates. All there was to read was the Bible.
My God, Nancy. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, Mac, it is. I just made it up. Truth is that I was a good scholar at the Sunday school when I was a little one. I happen to remember a lot of it. Remember most things. Call it an eidetic memory. Remember more things than I want sometimes.
They sailed on together in silence for 20 minutes or so.
Going to bring her around slow and easy onto a northerly course. I don't know how much progress the others will make during the night. We don't want to pass them. And I didn't want to risk running us onto a shoal in the dark.
There were some maps in the cabin.
I know, Mac, but if you have earthquakes powerful enough to totally alter the coastline of California, then, well, it's a fair bet the shallows and reefs might have shifted around some.
Mac nodded, feeling vaguely foolish for not having thought of that.
Of course.
Mac, you're an astrophysicist. 3 months ago, all this would have seemed like some drug-induced nightmare. Profoundly impossible. The world you knew, totally destroyed and reshaped. You're doing well enough, believe me.
His hand had dropped to clutch the steel hilt of the hunting knife on his hip.
Well enough? By Christ, Nancy. A dead wife, two dead sons, and a dead daughter. Boy, have I done fucking well.
You got a live wife and four live children, Mac. Batting better than 50%, and that's a damn sight better than you should expect.
You reckon?
Yeah, I reckon. And I know, Mac. Believe me on this. I know.
You want to talk to me, Nancy?
About who I am, and where do I come from, and what makes me tick.
The warning note couldn't have been clearer if she had shoved the muzzle of the Heckler & Koch in his mouth and cocked it. Mac shrugged, hands off.
Hey, come on, Nancy. You can't blame any of us for being curious. Just that it seems you know so much about the Hunters of the Sun and Zelig and all that shit.
I know some, but not all. I truly don't know where Aurora is. I figure it for somewhere close by the Cascades, but that covers a lot of miles.
For another few minutes, they remained silent while the Belle sailed on across the Painted Ocean.
You know, Mac, if we can make it to Aurora, you know that it's not going to be heaven on earth.
Sure. I guess I sort of see it as a kind of refuge, where some decent people have gotten themselves together to try and hit a lick for what's right. And I sound like John Wayne at the Alamo, but you know what I mean, Nancy. Someplace better.
She nodded, looking behind, then up at the sky.
Wind's still getting stronger. Could do with a reef in the sail. Better get below and wake up Jeff and Paul.
All right.
Then we'll swing around northerly and start moving back toward land. Someone can spell me at the wheel for a couple of hours. Best be you, Mac.
Good plan, Nancy.
In her desert bays, Margaret Tabor's office had a large clock on the wall with a sweep secondhand. It was old-fashioned compared with the rest of the flickering digital timekeepers around the place, but the leader of the Hunters of the Sun liked it. Somehow it gave a better feeling for the way seconds and minutes and hours were racing by, like fine sand tumbling out of a huge hourglass. You could watch it go. She turned and pressed the keys on her computer console, watching as the illuminated map on the far wall changed. Colored dots vanished and shifted, until all that remained were a number of silver lights. Some of them were speculative. Some of them were much more certain. She was wearing her own version of the hunter's uniform. Flagg originally designed it and chose the logo of the golden arrow piercing a silver sun. Her tight-fitting pants were tucked into highly polished black boots. A thin red stripe ran down each leg. There was a similar stripe down each arm of the black jacket. Beneath that was a white silk blouse, high at the throat. She pursed her full lips, considering the map. Knowing that the conglomerate of politicians and industrialists and senior officers from the old armed forces were all desperate to try to locate Zelig and his secret base. Like after the Echo Holocaust was polarizing, left and right, good and bad, dark and light. Margaret Tabor had not the least doubt in her razor-sharp mind that the Hunters of the Sun were the only force for the light. Silver dots, gleaming like shards of diamond, spilled onto a velvet cloth.
Ugh, power.
If only she had access to more power. Staggering amounts of irreplaceable gasoline were being expended to keep the base functioning. There were already one or two small, improvised plants working out in the desert at refining gas from crude. But it was a complex procedure, and devoured much more power to get it running. Zelig had already attracted several of the leading scientists who'd managed to survive beyond Earthblood. The Hunters were far less successful in that area, though they had plenty of weapons, men, survivalists, and lawyers. Margaret personally took charge of a murderous purge of some of the spineless and useless hangers-on at the base. Mouths were food. Food was power. Just to put one of their only two choppers into the air for an hour was a desperate decision. If only the right-thinking men and women who were the core of the Hunters had been able to read the future and take precautions as soon as the first red tendrils of the plant cancer appeared. Then they could have taken over huge stocks of gas. Zelig would have been long dead, his scrawny throat crushed beneath the heel of her boot. With more power, they would have tracked down the base in the northwest weeks ago.
Aurora, indeed.
Gradually, their patrols were closing in, narrowing it down to a radius of 150 miles from the ruined city of Seattle. As soon as the circle tightened further, it would be possible to mount a major operation with all their forces. The silver dots seemed to mock her. The landing of the space vessel Aquila, down at Stevenson Base, had been a total shambles for the Hunters of the Sun. Prime targets for enlistment escaped. Now where were they all? Some dead, she knew that. But she also knew that some of them were still very much alive. The dots showed the survivors clustering together on the west coast.
Enter.
She knew from the hesitancy and volume of the knock who was standing there. She also knew that he would knock again to be sure. She preempted him.
Come in, Owen.
Owen John was the latest in a surprisingly long line of older male assistants. Patience and tolerance weren't her strong points, and the lives of his predecessors tended to be short and not at all merry. But he hadn't been a volunteer. None of them were. Margaret's policy was to keep her eyes open around the compound for any men who reminded her of her own father. Then she would order them to become personal assistants to her. It wasn't an offer that you could refuse, because refusal meant instant painful death. Of course, acceptance also tended to lead to termination, in the long or the short term. Margaret Tabor didn't much like her own father, for reasons that remained locked away in the back rooms of memory.
What is it, Owen?
The white-haired man hesitated in the doorway to her office.
Come on, out with it.
Word from our contact on the coast of California.
Yes?
It looks like it could possibly be the Aquilas people.
Go on, Owen.
Two boats stolen from Eureka. Well, to be accurate, one of them was more like a ship, though I'm not sure quite when a boat becomes a ship. Only one of the...
Eureka! Where is that?
Yes. It's 282 miles north of San Francisco.
Good, Owen. That's good.
There was a sheen of perspiration on the man's forehead, and he nodded and smiled at Margaret, looking like a dysfunctional puppet. She realized that nerves had overcome him, and her sudden praise had made him forget that he hadn't yet given the whole message. She smiled encouragingly, wondering whether Owen would soon be making the trip to the narrow, bleak corridor with the meat hooks on the walls.
Go on.
Her fingers danced across the keyboard, and she watched the jerky movements of some of the silver lights on her large map.
You said that two vessels were taken?
Yes, two. A rowboat. Witnesses there spoke of a man and a girl about 12, and a youth who seemed clumsy, and a grown woman or a skinny man. They didn't seem too sure of all the details there.
Never mind, Owen.
There was killing.
Of course there was.
Three shot by a powerful handgun. Our contact says it was done with extreme precision at close range. And a boy was found, drowned, with a broken nose. That was later, when the sailing ship was stolen.
Who took that?
Owen swallowed hard, his prominent Adam's apple bobbing up and down, like an egg in a freezer bag.
Nobody saw them.
Except, perhaps, the drowned boy.
Eureka Bell, the name of the ship. Two sails. One at the front and a big one at the back, colored green.
The ship or the sails?
What?
Colored green. Vessel or sails, Owen?
Oh, sails. 40 feet long.
The sails are 40 feet long?
Owen hastily consulted a scribbled note that was already crumpled in his sweaty fingers.
The Eureka Bell is 40 feet long. No engine.
Margaret Tabor steepled her fingers on the desk in front of her and stared at them for several long seconds.
I think we might safely begin to assume that it is indeed the survivors of the Aquila, making for the north, and for Aurora, and the little shit-for-brain Zelig.
She looked again at the map, her concentration drawing the eyes of Owen. It made sense. The other sightings, the stupidity of her security people, and allowing the journalist and the mysterious old bitch to escape.
Is that all, Miss Tabor?
Yes, I believe it is, Owen. I think it's time I left this desk and set off north myself with some support. Time is passing. The game's afoot.
She waved a dismissive hand at the elderly man, watching him vanish. She was smiling again. ...1,200 miles away to the north, General John Kennedy Zelig considered his own agents scattered through the ravaged land. His office was considerably more low-tech than that of his most bitter enemy, and was set in one of the circle of Quonset huts that ranged around the sides of the Hidden Valley and the Pacific Cascade Mountains. Instead of dancing lights controlled by a high-powered computer complex, Zelig looked at a paper map on a board, covered with colored pins. He stood in front of it, absently fingering the badge in his lapel that represented his organization, the space flag with a circle of tiny silver suns set against a maroon background.
Closer, Jim Hilton.
The devastation wrought throughout the continent and throughout the entire world made it close to impossible to function with the kind of efficiency taken for granted before Earthblood. Gas supplies were minimal, which meant electricity depended on water or wind. Fortunately, Aurora had ample supplies of both. Operation Tempest, as it had been christened, also housed some of the finest minds from both the civil and military arms of government. Men and women were called together under the ultimate control of Zelig to try to help found a better world and sustain it against the gathering powers of evil and darkness. The general made a hasty note on a pad in his left hand, in the neat angular writing famous throughout his command, in a leprous green ink.
How long before hunters move after Aquila survivors? Not long.
He stalked back to his desk and sat down, rubbing at his left knee. He still suffered in cold, damp weather from an overtime injury sustained when he played running back at West Point.
Eureka.
He had a vague memory of having been there on a hiking vacation back in the 2020s, a gray place close to the gray Pacific. The quakes caused terrible devastation, interrupting his fragile lines of communication all down the West Coast, and the winter weather brought blizzards farther inland, closing off the tenuous highways for weeks on end. The word from Dorian Langford indicated that the stolen boat and the sailing ship were probably taken by some residue of the Aquila's crew. Zelig looked out of one of the windows of his hut and saw snow falling again. The thought of being on the ocean in a small rowboat didn't sound like the very best fun in the world. He hoped it was going well. The December cold bit at Jim Hilton's fingers, disrupting his coordination.
Shit! Shit!
He snatched at the butt of the Ruger, fumbling at the blued steel, nearly dropping it into the bottom of the rowboat. His eyes seemed mesmerized by the silent approach of the huge shark, now within spitting distance of Carrie, who was still deep in sleep. His mind was also numbed, and he felt confused by the imminence of the danger, unable to try to decide what he should be doing. Shout or shoot? The Ruger was finally in his fist, the spurred checkered hammer clicking back, the wide trigger smooth under his index finger. The shots ripped through the middle of the triangular dorsal fin, as near the water as he dared for maximum effect. Ragged chunks of flesh splattered in the calm sea. The shark veered away from the boat and dived suddenly, its monstrous tail rising from the ocean and pounding down, sending a wave of spray over everyone. Heather was jerked out of sleep by the freezing shower. Carrie also came awake, instinctively pulling her hand back into the boat.
Shark!
Carefully, Jim stood up, keeping his balance as the frail vessel rocked backward and forward in the turbulence caused by the creature's dive. The moonlight danced off the waves, and he couldn't see a thing.
Where, Dad?
The girl also stood, agile, staring all around them.
Was that the water?
The water pasted her short blonde hair flat against her skull, reminding Jim for a heart-stopping moment of how much like her mother the girl was.
Great white, I think. About three times the size of the boat.
Could be under us.
Sly suddenly became interested in what had happened.
Big fish?
Real big.
Jim held the revolver lightly, scanning the sea around them.
Fish on dish can skate on plate.
Quiet. This is dangerous, Sly. The fish is angry, and it could come after us and try to tip the boat over. So everyone keep still and quiet. Sit still, kitten. Heather, sit down.
Heather quickly sat down on one of the thwarts, turning her head from side to side to watch the serene expanse of ocean that surrounded them. There was no sign of land. Carrie drew her own gun, a six-shot .22 Smith & Wesson.
Carrie, the thing was bigger than a city transit bus. I doubt you can put a dent in it with that toy gun.
There!
Sly threw his right arm out toward the west in a dramatic gesture.
Big angry fish coming this way real speedy.
Oh, shit!
Carrie leveled her revolver and then thought better of it. There was blood leaking from two holes in the protruding fin, black in the faint moonlight. For a moment, the gigantic head lifted from the ocean, about 60 yards away from them, the marble chip eyes seeming to drill into Jim's skull.
It's not.
Not what?
Not a great white.
Jim was holding his Ruger, as steady as the boat's movement would permit.
How do you... What is it, then?
Basking shark. Eats plankton and stuff. Might have accidentally tipped us over, but it definitely wouldn't have eaten us, Dad. We shot it for nothing.
He kept the gun trained on the motionless creature, trying to figure out whether his daughter was right. The jaw didn't really seem like a great white, but it was still enormous.
Reckon it'll get over those two little holes.
I hope so, Dad. Look, it's going now.
They all watched as the shark cruised slowly away, moving with an effortless dignity toward the west in the expanse of open ocean, finally disappearing with a last imperious wave of the great tail.
Are we getting anywhere, Jim?
Sure.
We've been rowing hard for over an hour now, since the business with the shark, and I still don't see any sign of land. Can't go on forever.
Stop rowing a minute, Carrie.
They shipped their oars. There seemed to be a tight band of iron around his temples, and all the muscles in his chest and shoulders and arms and thighs and stomach were aching. Sly and Heather remained fast asleep, tangled together in the bow like puppies.
Could be there's an offshore current. I think we should be able to smell land by now, even if we can't see it yet.
I know you're the second fucking navigator, Carrie, but it doesn't make you some kind of fucking oracle about small boats in the fucking Pacific.
You're that worried, huh?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am sort of worried.
The velvet dark was fading, with a faint lightening of the sky to the east, where Jim knew that the coast of California must lie.
Could be we rowed too far west, and there was a current we didn't appreciate.
He leaned forward.
I don't know.
Carrie carefully stood up on her seat, balancing with outstretched arms. She put her hands around her eyes to try to focus her vision to the east.
Just water. Wait a minute.
What?
Well, you know, the word was there'd been big floods. Pacific spilled in for miles and miles after the quakes.
She sat down again, smiling at him, her teeth a pale blur in the dim light.
Sure. So it'd be like a big new bay. If the lie of the land was right, it could be anything like 50 to 100 miles or more across.
The boat drifted gently while they both considered the idea. In the gloom to the west, it sounded as if a whale had breached.
We'd best keep rowing, but head north as well as east, you reckon?
Don't ask me, Captain. You know, I'm only the second fucking navigator, not some fucking oracle on small boats on the fucking Pacific.
They both bent their aching muscles to the task. Sly woke shortly after that and took his turn on the oars. He was so eager to please that he had to be gentled down, or he'd have rowed at 100 miles per hour for 3 minutes, and then collapsed exhausted. As it was, he kept a steady tempo on the bow thwart, while the other three took turns at keeping him company on the stern oars. Dawn came up slowly behind a bank of pewter cloud that lay across the eastern horizon like an unwanted guest.
Storms.
Snow, likely.
What do we do when we reach land, Dad? How do we move on?
Steal something, I guess.
In and out and thin and fat and bin and bat and thin and tat and dim and out and in and out.
Jim steered a course that brought them back toward the land that should have been. Heather was sitting in the bow, head over the side, picking out items in the clear water below them.
Saw a big sort of eel thing. And there's... I can see a gas station sign.
Stop rowing, Sly, and hang on to the oars.
Jim leaned to his left, trying to squint past the dawn light that was glinting off the dappled surface of the ocean. For a few moments, he could see nothing at all. Then a shoal of tiny silver fish went skittering past, only inches beneath him. Then he saw it. It was a semicircular sign, red lettering on white. It was smeared over with bright green algae, a sure sign that the planet was picking its way back from the brink of the Earthblood extinction. The white pole of the sign ghosted down to vanish from sight into the deeps below them. Jim could just make out the dim, shimmering block of what might have been the buildings of the gas station.
Land.
Now they had to be more cautious. If they tried to go too fast, they might spike the boat on a pylon or a submerged antenna. But now that they knew that their suspicion was correct, everyone was happier as they searched the horizon in every direction. Carrie spotted the first true sign of land, about 2 miles to the north, a low gray shape emerging from the misty cloud of a rain squall.
There!
She pointed to what Jim reckoned to be close to true north, maybe even a little west. It proved that they were in a monstrous new bay created by the earthquakes. Even in the murky daylight, they couldn't see any sign of land away to their east, though there was a vague smudge on the horizon that could have been higher ground. Jim was appalled at the extent of the devastation.
Must be 100 miles wide and about the same from north to south.
Are we going over there? Up ahead?
Her father nodded.
If my back doesn't break first with all this rowing.
Don't want to break my back, Jim.
Just a way of talking, Sly.
Jim leaned over to pat the boy reassuringly on the shoulder.
Listen, we couldn't have done this trip without your help and strength, Sly. You've done real good. Real, real good.
You tell Dad that, Jim?
How can he? You know that
your father's gone on ahead to a different place, Sly, but he can see what you do and he's going to be terribly proud of you.
Sly beamed at her.
And goody good for me.
Heather glanced at Carrie and Jim.
Sorry. Didn't think.
Don't worry. We're all bone weary, kid. Get to land and catch up on some sleep. That's what I'm most looking forward to.
Stop rowing.
Jim sat in the stern, fingers cramped around the tiller of the little vessel. Oddly, it seemed to be chillier now than when they first started their voyage, with sleet now falling among the rain. Sly and Carrie both followed his orders, carefully bringing the oars in and laying them along the bottom of the boat. Heather was poised in the bow, holding the coil of rope, ready to jump out onto the spit of land. They passed through a bank of drizzle. Everyone was cold and tired and wet, but at least they were going to be back on solid, if not dry, land. Jim's wristwatch, when he wiped it clean, showed it was close to noon. He glanced behind him to the open ocean and farther south to distant Eureka. The sky was dull. Clouds pressed down onto the surface of the sea, as if air and water were somehow merging into each other. For a fraction of a moment, the cloud shifted, and he thought he glimpsed a ship far, far off, with dark-colored sails, blue or green. Then the wind veered, and the curtain closed, and the vessel vanished.
Painted ship on a painted ocean.
He dredged the phrase from his high school memory. His attention turned back to the land. Jim wrinkled his forehead at the realization that he'd been careless. He'd been surviving in the ravaged world for long enough to know that if you wanted to stay alive, you checked and then you checked again. And after that, you checked once more. But there was no sign of life. Dreary hillsides, bare of any vegetation, showed only the stumps of dead trees. It looked as though there had recently been a high tide, with mud and drifted detritus spread all along the waterline. Jim spotted what looked like blacktop approximately 50 feet above them, running north to south, likely the highway that they'd have taken if they hadn't been forced into the detour of Eureka. There was also a burned-out building along to the left, with smoke-blackened walls and glassless windows. It was just possible a mile or so north to see some higher ground, dusted with fine snow. Heather was standing up as the boat drifted in, almost silently, its keel grating in the dirt. She turned around and grinned at her father.
Like Columbus, or the Pilgrims. Shall I claim this new and unknown land in the name of the Hilton family? Or in the name of Aurora?
Heather fell over the side of the boat into the shallow water. The shot came from somewhere inland, close to the road. Jim spotted a puff of smoke blown instantly away. That wasn't what mattered. His mind blanked at the realization of blind disaster. Pamela McGill stood on the main deck of the Eureka Bell, staring out ahead. It was freezing cold, with no sign of the sun, though her father claimed it wasn't all that far off noon. The land had been visible for some time now. Paul clambered up on the mainmast an hour ago and shouted down that he could see it. Now it was more than just a blur. There were some snow-tipped mountains to the north. The bay that the earthquake created seemed to stretch inland for dozens of miles, and had totally altered the shape of the coast.
See anyone, child?
Nancy had come up behind her, silent as ever.
No. Is there something on the beach there?
The older woman shaded her eyes.
Lord gave you good sight. Oh, I can just make out. Well, I'll take your word for it. What do you figure?
Driftwood?
Dead seal?
Rowboat?
Ah.
Nancy glanced back to where Henderson McGill was at the wheel.
Bring her up a couple points into the wind, Mac. Yeah, better.
A rowboat girl? Well, now, wouldn't that be interesting?
Why didn't we come straight north, Nancy? We must be much faster than Jim Hilton.
Two things. First, we could have overrun them in the dark. Second, this bay is just a load of sea pouring over a lot of land. Absolutely no way of knowing what lay under our keel 100 feet or 2 feet beneath. Soft mud, or the roof of a church set to pluck out our timbers like the sweet bird of youth taking petals off a rose.
Of course. Stupid of me.
Yes. Yes, it was.
Jean stood by her ex-husband, glowing on her hands.
Colder than earth blood charity, Mac.
Her breath plumed out ahead of her, drifting away over the high stern.
Snow yonder. Farther north we have to go, then the worse the weather's likely to get.
Where are we going to land?
Jocelyn joined them.
Suki's sick. She says she's cold.
We all are. I was just asking your father where we land.
Mac ran his fingers through his wet, thinning hair.
No harbors on account of the quakes. Maybe we'll keep on sailing north until we reach Seattle. Just wondering whether and how we'd finally put into land.
Nancy looked at Mac for several seconds, stock still, her eyes seeming to drill right through his head. Then she blinked and came close to smiling.
Just spent a few minutes with Jefferson in the anchor lockup under the bow, and I swear it's taken my mind clean off matters.
Mac glanced down and noticed that there was a tiny thread of fresh blood near the heel of her left boot. And again he wondered about what the ill-matched couple did together in their private moments.
You asked me where we were going. I gave some thought to keeping on north, save us some time and possibly a deal of grief. We could be in Puget Sound in a couple of days, sailing day and night with a fair wind round Cape Flattery and Low Point and Angeles Point, through the Admiralty Inlet, maybe put ashore at Squamish, across the Sound. If we travel by land, it might take us a month with the bad weather I smell in the air.
So, you make it seem a good option, Nancy. But the way you say it, it makes it sound like putting your neck into a noose.
She nodded and patted him on his bearded cheek.
Good, Paul, good. You see and you listen. Rare qualities. Keep you living when all about start dying. Neck in a noose? Maybe. My guess, ladies and gentlemen, for what it might be worth, is that the Hunters of the Sun have a network of informers strung across this pink and unpleasant land.
How about Zelig? He had the same?
Possibly, Mac. And the nearer we get to Aurora, then the more that's likely. But I am of the opinion, most strongly, that it'll be known that two vessels were stolen from Eureka. Like pointing a finger. They'll know we'll go north. Have to, but how far? Best would be to keep sailing.
So
we aim for what we think might be an abandoned rowboat right ahead, sail her straight onto the beach, helmsman, and damn the torpedoes.
The little ones, Suki and Jocelyn, were bundled together in front of the mast with a pile of blankets around them. Paul had been delegated, along with Jean, To keep a careful eye on their safety, Pamela was positioned up in the bows, told to watch out for any last-minute underwater danger. Mac took the wheel, ready to respond to any order from Nancy. Jeff was up on deck and leaned on the rail close to Mac. He couldn't help noticing the smear of bright blood just beneath his swollen lip.
What can I do, Nancy?
Keep out of the way until we hit. The Lord alone knows what'll happen then, but try to make yourself useful. Don't just save your own skin, Jeff, will ya? You recall what happens to folks who do that.
The ex-journalist flushed without answering her and turned away to look at the approaching shoreline.
Shouldn't we lower the sail? Going in at a hell of a lick.
No, faster the better. Farther we dig in, the easier and safer to get off.
Rocks!
Pamela pointed with her hand to a spot about 50 yards ahead of the vessel and a touch to the left. Mac moved the wheel to take the Eureka Belle a couple of points to starboard.
Don't take too much way off her.
Mac didn't answer, keeping his eyes on his oldest daughter, who gave him the thumbs up to show that they were safely clear of the submerged obstruction.
Look like a garage roof!
Steady as she goes.
Nancy stood at the rail, looking up at the low, rain-washed hills around them. The Port Royal was in her hands.
Aye, aye, skipper.
Mac resented the tone of the woman's voice. A gust of sleet made him blink. As the coast rushed toward them, Henderson McGill wondered what he was doing there. It crossed his mind a few times since the Aquila came splintering in from deep space that he might be living through a complex and barely believable nervous breakdown. That one day the drugs would work, and he'd snap out of it, to find himself between clean sheets in an Air Force veterans hospital, with both wives and all seven children smiling at him.
No fucking way.
He braced himself, ready for what he knew would be a substantial crash.
80 yards! 50!
Jeff Thomas was crouched behind the bulwark on the port side, his eyes fixed behind him at Nancy. He was rehearsing in his mind the different ways he might eventually choose to slaughter her when the time was right. The impact was surprisingly gentle. The earth was soft and muddy, and the bow of the ship drove into it, gradually decelerating until it stopped. The vessel stood motionless, leaning just a little to the port side, with the sails flapping helplessly on the yards. Paul picked up Suki and carried her to the rail, showing her the misty land.
Collect everything and we'll move.
Nobody seemed to be responding.
Let's go! Anyone watching the coast for 20 miles either way will have seen this tub running aground here. The rowboat might already have attracted attention. There could be hunters of the sun already crawling around out there. We stand out like a dead dog on a snowbank.
A bank of rain swept down over them, cutting visibility to less than 50 yards, clearing away again as quickly as it had come. Nancy paced the sloping deck, looking worriedly at the dreary landscape, paying particular attention to a trestle bridge that carried the highway over what had once been a creek and was now a part of the Pacific Ocean.
Hurry up!
Dancing as fast as I can. If you lent a hand instead of standing there like Lord God Almighty, we'd be ready quicker.
Nancy ignored her and continued to watch the land. Pamela turned from her spot in the bow.
How do we get over the side? Quite a big drop to the shore.
Be clear of the water.
Yeah, Nancy.
Bound to be a rope ladder on the boat someplace. Mac, see what you can find.
Mac climbed down the steep companionway and felt his way through the darkness. He could hear feet moving on the deck just above his head. As Nancy, Jeff, and his family walked from side to side, the boat shifted slightly, its stern still surrounded by the ocean. Mac was no judge of tides, but he guessed that if it were coming in, then the Eureka Belle would soon be fully afloat again.
Got anything?
Nancy's shadow filled the hatch behind him.
Yeah.
His fingers touched a rope ladder hung on the wall to his left. Margaret Tabor had been preparing her armed mission to the north. Aviation fuel was in such short supply that she was forced to compromise, eventually ending up with two Chinook CH-47Ms, each capable of carrying around 50 armed men with supplies for a week. But there was no knowing where the next gas stop might be, so one of them was partly loaded with high-octane fuel. By juggling around with the figures, Tabor worked out that one of the Chinooks would have to be sacrificed along the line in order to get the other helicopter to the region of the Cascades. Then, if they found Aurora and purged it clean, they might come across more fuel stocks and be in a position to return safely to their southwest base. Even the loss of both choppers would be worth it, if it meant the end of Zelig and his swelling rebellion in the north. All the faceless, nameless heads of the Hunters of the Sun were agreed on that. They had a total of 68 men, all supplied with the best state-of-the-art weapons the hunters could give them. It meant depleting their armory to a dangerously low level, but the game had to be worth the gamble.
If we lose this one, then we are all lost, now and forever. This is the one throw of the dice. I say we will win it.
The rest of the Supreme Council of the Hunters of the Sun agreed. She received a couple of coded radio messages during the day of December 21st from the isolated part of the coast, north of the devastated quake zone. They related to the stealing of the boat and the sailing ship from Eureka the previous night. Communications across any distance in the New World were difficult, again because of immense problems over power. But these found their way successfully through the network. Of necessity, both were brief. Both were of considerable interest to the woman.
Your warning correct. 4 turtles from sea. 1 down. No problem. Ready to track remainder.
When she read that, the chief nodded and smiled. The point of the entire costly exercise hadn't been to try to kill all the survivors of the Aquila. It had been to try to locate them and then follow until they walked through the gates of Aurora. Then they could all be properly killed. The second message arrived a few hours later and came from a different source. This made her scowl.
Flock of birds landed and one plucked, but hunting stopped.
The gap in the message was followed by...
Trail cold and lost. We'll try but not hopeful. Snow.
The immediate wave of blinding anger frightened Margaret herself. A part of the message had been lost, but it wasn't hard to guess the broken word was permanent. Nor was it hard for Margaret Tabor to read the unacceptable story between the thinly coded lines. She crumpled up the paper and threw it into the shredder. The first message presented no problems. The small boat reached shore north of the massive new bay, gouged into the coastline. 4 people in it, which tied in with the other spies' reports. And one of them had been killed in the incident. The others would be tracked. That was all good news. The second message was grim, and made her doubt, for a few heartbeats, her own planning. More of the survivors landed, probably in the sailing ship from Eureka. One of them had also been killed by the waiting assassin, who had probably seen them coming and chose to wait before beginning to track them, letting the others go ahead. That was how she read it. But then something went wrong. The hidden killer himself went down. The result was that she had once again lost the trail, and it grew ever colder with every hour that passed. Already it was, she checked the clock, 4 hours since the discovery that her shooter had been removed from the field. Too long.
It'll be dark soon.
Outside her window, she could see the 2 Chinook helicopters being readied for the journey north. Now it must wait until tomorrow. Zelig also received 2 messages, but technical problems delayed them and caused confusion. The temperature in the Cascades dropped sharply during the early part of the 21st. A fierce blue norther came hacking its way down from the Canadian coast, carrying in its churning belly the seeds of a storm from still farther away, across the frozen Bering Strait, in the ice-bound Kamchatka Peninsula of what used to be Russia. Despite efforts to fight it off with a high-pressure steam hose, glittering ice coated the main radio antenna. The antenna eventually folded in the middle like a gutshot cowboy. It took hours of hard, unremitting labor in bitter weather to carry out some of the repairs and jury-rig an alternative antenna. The first message came in just before the main antenna went crashing down.
No sign either set players anywhere north of Illyria, searching both ways.
Illyria was the agreed code name for the town of Eureka. So, both the boat and the sailing ship disappeared off the face of the planet. Then came the blank time that their contact might have been sending them other news, because the only other message they received didn't seem to quite follow.
One member from one home team struck out. Visiting pitcher also fouled out. Remaining players, both teams gone separately.
Zelig sat and considered the 2 flimsy yellow sheets of paper. He wasn't surprised that both the rowboat and the sailing vessel had not been spotted. For most of the time they'd been out at sea, they probably kept a decent distance from the treacherous shore, and he knew the weather had been bleak and wet, with poor visibility. But the second message opened up a can of worms. The operator made the point that reception was poor and inexact, and there could be errors in it. But the suggestion was that one of the survivors from the Aquila, or someone traveling with them, had been murdered. The visiting pitcher was obviously an assassin from the Hunters of the Sun, who had in turn been killed.
Nancy?
One dead from the shrinking group of travelers battling toward Aurora was seriously bad news. One hired killer less on the opposition was modestly good news. Heather Hilton, 11 years old, survived the cholera epidemic that stole away both her mother and her twin sister, Andrea. With short blonde hair and gray-blue eyes, she was well-built and mature for her years, old before her time. She'd been standing in the bow of the rowboat as it grated against the muddy shore, ready to jump, and turn to share a joke with her father, with Carrie and Sly. Suddenly she heard, perhaps felt, a vibration. A ferocious, high-pitched humming went past the side of her face as she turned. It would have hit her if she hadn't made that sudden movement. She'd experienced a brief, heart-stopping sensation of fiery heat, and a smell like nothing she'd ever known before. A hot, dangerous smell that came and went in an instant. Heather threw her arms wide, the rope dropped, and her feet slipped on the damp wood of the boat. Before she even knew what was happening, she fell over the side into the freezing, shallow water. Jim spotted the white puff of smoke from a rifle, heard the ringing echo of the shot, saw his only child scream and fall from sight. For a few endless moments, his heart seemed to jutter to a halt in his chest, his mind blank. Time ceased for him as he stared at the empty front of the little boat. His hand found the Ruger, and he was aiming it toward the bridge that carried the short stretch of elevated highway over the invading sea, where he saw the hidden gunman. But Carrie was quicker. Her little 22 was snapping away, at a range where it was unlikely to do much serious harm, but might be enough to make the assassin get his head down. Jim's finger slipped over the trigger. He saw a tiny puff of concrete from one of the bridge supports. Sly rocked backward and forward, hugging himself, tears coursing down his plump cheeks.
Dad! Get out of there!
Jim was about to squeeze the trigger for a fourth time when he froze. Heather was peering at him over the side of the rowboat, her face drenched in seawater, her hair dripping wet.
You aren't?
Of course she wasn't dead. There she was.
Miss me, Dad! Close, though! Come on, before the shooting starts again!
Right. Carrie, take Sly and head...
He looked around him.
Head that way!
He was pointing north, where the land seemed to be cut and seamed with valleys and would give them better cover.
Grab everything and go, all of you!
The clouds had lowered around them, bringing sheets of mist and a more persistent drizzle. It cut visibility right down, and the highway bridge had completely vanished into the murk when Jim looked back. He hastily reloaded the Ruger, keeping it fully charged, though his fingers were cold and the full metal jacket rounds were slick in the rain. Heather and Carrie dragged Sly out of the boat, along with whatever supplies they could grab. Another rifle shot went hissing wide, digging a neat round hole in the sea, only a few yards beyond them. Jim stood up and took aim. He jumped out into the muddy earth, boots sinking in over the ankles. It was impossible to make any sort of speed, and he stopped, aiming up to where he thought the bridge was. Jim didn't try to reload again, but concentrated on getting them all into some sort of cover. Though he'd never been combat trained, he guessed that the person on the hillside above them was alone. Otherwise, there would have been more shooting, a volley of fire, raking the boat and slaughtering them all. Also, if they could just get some dead ground between themselves and the rifle, then the fact that they had two guns might be enough to deter the would-be killer from following them. As they covered the 100 yards or so to safety, the rain turned to snow. While they all crouched panting in the lee of a steep hillside, the sleet storm thickened into a full-blown blizzard.
What now?
Shelter and a fire. Best move on north for a mile or so if we can all make it. Then a shelter and a fire. Dry out or we die. Especially you, Heather.
Jim was filled with a sudden realization that his beloved daughter had come within an inch or so of being killed. And he knelt by her and threw his arms around her slender, soaked body.
Christ. I love you. I love you so much.
Jesus Christ!
Mac burst out from the companionway of the Eureka Bell, a dark fear driving him blindly forward through the wet flakes of snow drifting down onto the timbers of the beached ship, turning it instantly into a Christmas card scene.
Get your head down!
Nancy was kneeling near the bow with Paul and Jean. The two younger girls were huddled together by the mast. Dazedly, Mac noticed that they were both crying. He crouched down. A long splinter of white wood peeled itself off the rail of the vessel, a couple of feet behind him, followed by a distant rifle shot. He wanted to ask if everybody was all right, but the words seized up in his throat. Then he spotted Pamela lying on her back, her head in Jean's lap, Paul holding her hands in his. Nancy was sitting cross-legged on the deck, looking down at the teenage girl with an expressionless face. To the right, Jeff Thomas had flattened himself behind one of the raised hatch covers. Mac was conscious of a lot of blood all over his daughter's chest, running onto the deck.
She's done for, Mac. Stay here.
Can't be.
He knelt down and looked into his daughter's eyes. She was still alive. The blood was pumping from the gaping wound. Her lips moved as though she were trying to speak.
What? What is it, honey?
Sorry, Dad.
Mac watched her die, saw the spark of life leave her eyes, saw them turn into dull mirrors, his own anxious, distraught face distorted and reflected in them. For a moment, her body seemed to tense, then it relaxed into the unmistakable finality of death.
Oh, Jesus, Pam. No. Not you too. Jesus. I love you.
Stay here.
Mac hardly heard Nancy. One arm had gone around Jean, and the other was brushing a wet tendril of bloodied hair from his daughter's forehead.
What?
He half turned and saw that Nancy had vanished from his side.
Where did...
Over the side, Dad.
Paul's white hands still held his dead sister's fingers. Nancy landed easily, despite the drop from the rail. The snow had thickened, though it was melting wherever it touched the wet, muddy earth. The gunman was up on the bridge. She was sure of that. It was the best vantage point, and that's where she'd have placed herself if she'd been given the takeout mission. The Port Royal machine pistol was slung across her shoulders, the survivor of the matched pair of Heckler & Koch P-111s holstered at her hip. She knew she'd move faster with both hands free. Nancy kept close to the water's edge, certain that the snow was thick enough to make her invisible. Before it had started, she'd already noted the lie of the land, seeing a steep-sided ravine running to the left of the creek that would bring her up and under the highway. The 60-year-old woman was hardly panting as she reached the looming shadow of the metal and concrete structure. Now, beneath it, she could see that the bridge had been badly damaged by the recent quakes. Iron had buckled, and great chunks of the stone had cracked and fallen away into the stream below. Water trickled through a gaping split in the actual bed of the blacktop, leaving a rusty stain on the fissured concrete. Nancy continued climbing, slower, more cautious, until she had worked her way up to a level even with the ribboned road. Here, she was able to look directly across to the ocean side. There was a figure lying there, using one of the rectangular drainage holes as a shooting point. As Nancy watched, she saw the rifle at his shoulder. The killer wore a dark blue rain poncho and had a rucksack at the elbow. Spare ammo was laid neatly out in clips on a square of oilcloth. Nancy drew the 9mm automatic and picked her way off the slick hillside onto the highway, moving through the drifting snow like a cat. Normally, she would have simply put a bullet through the back of the shooter's skull, quick and totally safe, but she was curious. The killing shot that took the life of Pamela McGill had been a good one, fired downhill through misty rain. The snow fell in feathery clumps, only revealing the outline of the beached ship for a couple of seconds at a time. Nancy looked down along the line of the rifle barrel, past the scope sight, seeing that nobody was now visible on the deck. The body of Pamela McGill had been dragged away, leaving only a dark smudge on the wet timbers. There were patches of snow settling on the crumbled blacktop, reminding Nancy of the road signs. Bridge freezes before a highway. It was true. She edged closer until she was less than 8 feet away from the killer, and pointed the automatic right between his shoulders. In pulps and videos, the hero always managed to find something witty to say to the villain. Nancy knew that trying to be a smartass could be a sure way of getting yourself killed.
Keep very still. Very still.
The hooded figure started, as though someone had applied electrodes to fingers and toes. The barrel of the rifle jerked a few inches to the right, then held motionless.
Good. Lay the pretty rifle down, and then real slow, take the hood off and roll onto your back. Your hands come up with anything but air in them, and you're dead. Now do it.
I know you.
Move first. Talk later.
It's Nancy Sims. By God, if they told me you were involved, I'd have been one too many mornings and 1,000 miles away. They didn't tell me.
Wouldn't, would they?
That bitch Margaret Tabor did in flag, and now she's done in me.
Now Nancy knew him. The voice brought back a damn burst of memories. A tall, slender young man from where?
Spearfish?
Right.
You're Burnett. Savior Burnett.
He laid the rifle in the slush, and the hands came up and tugged the dark hood back off the head, revealing a white, stubbled skull. Very slowly the man rolled over, blinking as the snow fell in his face.
Keep the hands at your sides.
The slicker was partly open, and she could see the tiny badge glittering in the poor light, a golden arrow piercing the heart of a silver sun.
Old times, Nancy.
Something like a smile tugged at the corners of the narrow mouth.
Not worth forgetting.
The white colonial house on the edge of Rehoboth, 60 miles or so southwest of Petersburg, in rural Virginia. Special forces training, 30 years ago, longer. Xavier was a young man, and she allowed him to seduce her. It was strictly forbidden by their gray-suited overlords. It took more ingenuity and energy to keep their affair going than it had in the classes in destabilization in Southeast Asia and bridge-blowing and silent killing.
It's just a job, Nancy.
I don't have the time. It was a fair shot to take out the girl. Real big threat. Girl of 18.
A job, like I said.
Heard the gun. Knew it was someone good. Nice. Kragoff von Primus. Double rifle over and under. Similar to the tech, but it's got detachable side locks. 375. Cursed in action. Double underlugs. Walnut stock. Shit, why am I talking? You know the specs as well as I. But even a nice piece like that can't see to fire through a blizzard, can it?
I've done all right so far. Two notches carved. It'll please Miss Tabor.
He corrected himself, looking into the barrel of the Heckler & Koch.
Would have pleased her.
The robo? How many?
Burnett started to move his hands, and she gestured with the pistol.
No.
Oh, sorry, Nancy. Four. Older man, clumsy boy, young woman and a kid. I checked the kid.
You always were one for the easy meat, Xavier. What about the others?
He didn't answer for a moment.
Come on, you know that this can be quick and easy, or it can be really rather slow and devilishly painful.
Not lost a touch, have we, Nancy?
I haven't. You have. That's why I'm standing here and you're lying down there. Quickly.
They had a bastard arsenal. Kept me ducking and it was snowing then.
When?
3-4 hours ago. Figured they headed north. My job wasn't to follow.
Two girls, Xavier. Get you a gold watch from the Hunters of the Sun?
It's work. Find a good place, watch for a rowboat and a sailing ship, take out as many as you can. Others like me strung out along the coast. I got lucky.
Matter of opinion, Xavier.
Hell, I guess that's right. Any point am I asking you to let it lie for the sake of old times, Nancy? Please. I'm saying please. I used to like it when I begged.
Indeed. Then, and this is now.
The snow was easing, and she could see across the parapet of the bridge that someone was sticking their head over the rail of the ship way below her. Burnett, with that scope-sided rifle, was good enough to take the top off anyone's skull at that range.
Please. I could be useful to Zelig.
Cold-cocking backstabber. What would he want with that savior? An old man. A careless old man.
She leveled the gun between his pleading, watery blue eyes. He opened his mouth, trembling.
You remember me in your prayers, Nancy.
Who would I pray to, Xavier?
His legs kicked once, and then he was still. A half-remembered rhyme came to Nancy as she holstered the Heklarid coat, stooping to pick up the rifle and add it to the Port Royal over her shoulders.
I'll remember you, Xavier. And you think of me when it's kissing time beneath the stars.
She spat in the upturned face and started the slow, slippery climb back down the hill through the drifting snow to rejoin the others on the beach.
At least there's no shortage of stuff to burn.
Jim Hilton carried in a huge pile of broken fencing. He dumped it in the corner of the derelict beach hut, a mile and a half north of their landing place.
Even that'll be used up in the end.
Carrie was on her knees, blowing at the glowing heart of their small fire.
No more trees. No more wood.
Heather had stripped down to her underwear and was sitting with a sleeping bag around her, shivering like an aspen in a thunderstorm. She was waiting for the flames to catch so that she could start to get warm and dry her soaking clothes. Sly Ramiro was cradling his crudely carved wooden doll he called Steve, after his father. He kept it tucked into his shirt most of the time. Now he was talking to it.
Cold and wet, Steve, as well as that hungry. Snow falling a lot. I remember Steve said it was devil picking chickens. Been on boat since last time I talked to you, Steve. Felt sick. Scared and sick. Now we got fire. Well, soon. Soon get fire. Soon.
Jim watched as the tiny flames grew and the wood began to crackle. Through the open doorway of the hut, he could see out into the afternoon murk, with snow blowing by. December 21st, 4 days away from Christmas. As though she'd been reading her father's mind, Heather caught his eye.
It's not gonna be the usual kind of Christmas, is it, Dad?
Hardly.
At least we got us some Yule logs on an open fire, or whatever the song says.
Carrie straightened, her face red and smudged with smoke from her efforts to get the wood burning. The branches, some of them dried pine, were beginning to spit out sparks, making Sly jump and look up from his monologue.
Little guns.
All we need now is some chestnuts.
Ooh, and a buttered turkey decorations.
Carrie wiped her nose on her sleeve.
Silver and tinsel and shining glass globes that make your face look all distorted.
I like Christmas. Mom didn't give big presents. Said I didn't need them. Steve used to give goodies. Remember that?
Jim had heard about Allison Romero, Steve's disaffected wife, from Kyle. Heard about the way she'd try to hang on to Sly, though it didn't seem as though she had an awful lot of love for the intensely lovable teenager. Jim wondered for a moment whether the woman stayed up in Colorado.
Old movies on TV. Relatives on the phone. I can still remember talking to Mom and Dad the time before they died. Christ, it's only a couple of years ago. They were talking about the vacation they planned for their silver anniversary. Revisiting some places from other trips. Yellowstone, where they met that jackknifing Semite. Glacier. Montana. They took me there. Many glaciers. The walk around the lake.
Carrie was staring blankly down into the glowing flames as she remembered.
Big dining room with waiters and waitresses singing. The Grinnell hike. Grizzlies somewhere around. Mom insisted on wearing a dozen of those bells around her neck to warn the bears that she was coming. Said it would be just her luck to get eaten by a deaf grizzly.
Jim leaned back, his hand falling onto the cold butt of the Ruger. The sensation jerked him back from the worlds of Christmas's past into the world of Earthblood present and its menaces.
Think we should post a guard, Carrie?
She turned slowly to him, her eyes not seeming to focus properly for several seconds.
Sorry, Jim. I was still walking those clean mountains with Mom and Dad. Wow. Nostalgia's a good country to visit now and again, but I don't want to take out permanent residency there. Guard? Sure. Yeah, I guess we should have done that already. The smoke from this fire could bring anyone for miles.
Jim looked out.
Winds from the east take the scent out to sea, and the snow will muffle it. We can't be too careful around here now after the shooting.
In his heart,